Do you still think you can escape, number six?
I'm going to do better than that.
Oh?
Going to escape and come back.
Come back?
I mean, escape, come back, wipe this place off the face of the earth, obliterate it, and you with it.
Well, it's Friday. It's 6 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Ousted by the Bristol Mafia from Bristol Community Radio, if you can believe that, on Friday the 6th of May 2022, the day after we had our referendum here in Bristol to decide whether to keep this idea of a US-style mayor or go back to the old traditional British committee system. And we are streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, an arts centre in Jamaica Street in Bristol, and also at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with psychological warfare, propaganda and medical misinformation sometimes even, where tens of thousands of Brits are having all sorts of problems with vaccines. That's not really being reported much either. Adverse reactions to those vaccines, as well as obviously with the disease itself. A hostile environment being created often for readers, listeners and viewers to the London press. We do it differently here. We do local, national and international news and comment from a regional hub, which is really what goes on in other countries, many other countries. Germany, for example, does this, but not here in Britain. It all comes from London. Trying to herd us into the metaverse. How are they going to get on with that? Well, metaverse leader Mark Zuckerberg has still got two weeks of ban of me to run, which was quite interesting to see how suddenly, just exactly the same as happened in April 2021, in April 2022, just before the local elections, and this year, just before the referendum, suddenly Facebook bans me for the period of the election and after it too. Which is rather strange. Funnily enough, there's been money going to advertise our mayor to Facebook. So maybe this is just a simple quid pro quo. Who knows? Anyway, navigating us calmly, for the most part, through the Matrix is Irish Republican activist Martin Summers. Also joining us is the councillor for Knowle, independent councillor now, not a Lib Dem anymore, Gary Hopkins. So in part one, voters defeat the Bristol Mafia. Well, that's my headline for it. Business West, property speculators and the merchant venturers is what I'm talking about. These are the people who have a lot of clout here in the city, and the merchant venturers particularly, really since medieval times. They kind of own the city. They like to think it's their little plaything. And they've been able, with the mayor, to have a lot more influence in politics through being able to manipulate one person. That is to say, the Blairite Labour mayor, Marvin Rees. Also this week, BP and Shell profits, another massive record quarter profits. Isn't it funny how the prices all went up at end of last year, didn't they? In 2021, suddenly now these companies are making annual profits totalling £50 billion. That's just profit. That's nothing, not turnover, folks, profit. Also, we'll be hearing from the pandemic podcaster, James Dellingpole. He's done a very interesting interview this week about the history of problems with vaccines. And in part two, US President Biden pledges $33 billion to Ukraine. Boris, a bit embarrassing, he's only pledging £300 million for Ukraine. But we'll have a good old look at Ukraine in the second part. But to begin with, joined by Gary Hopkins. Hi, Gary, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. After being ousted from the community radio, we're still going strong here because many of our listeners listen from around the world. It's nice to be able to give a Bristol eye view of what's going on in the UK, because everything's so London-centric. I get rather peeved with this. What about you?
Well, not only I'm against centralism, not just from London, but from the centre of Bristol. I mean, basically, Bristol is a series of small communities, and very often, particularly with the present mayor that's on his way out now, there's been an ignoring of local feelings and the contributions that communities can actually make.
So we're talking about centralisation of power here too, really. This is all quite unhealthy, Martin, isn't it? Centralisation of power. We've got a result this morning announced, early in this morning, which is 59% of Bristolians that voted against the mayor and for the committee system, and 41% thought the mayor was a good idea.
Yeah, if it's not in, out of line with what I would have thought was going to happen, because those who didn't want wanted to change the system were the ones who were motivated to go and vote.
Well, they actually forced the referendum in the first
place. Well, exactly. So, and of course, a lot of people are not that engaged with the issue. The majority didn't participate, so they didn't care that much either way. So we've now got a change in the system. It's clear that the majority that did vote want to change the system, so that is what's going to happen.
Well, my impression is Bristol just got a little bit lighter overnight. The idea of having a single person making all these decisions, hasn't it made the role of councillors like yourself much less important, Gary? Because, I mean, we like to think that when we elect somebody that they have a say, most importantly, really, in the budget, in how this £350 million or whatever it is every year is spent our money.
The budget is a classic example of what's wrong with the system, the way it's actually been operated. I put forward a budget amendment which said some unused money that the council actually had should be lent at a cost to the Jubilee pool for the new owners taking over so that they could make some environmental improvements. Majority of councillors voted for that, should have gone through, and then the mayor comes along and vetoes it and actually leans on the trustees who are taking over to actually get them to say that they didn't want the money. I mean, it just is absolutely shocking.
Sounds like, actually, you know, it's not just politics, it's also a bit of bullying involved.
Oh, huge bullying, yes.
So can you just take us through the story of how this referendum came about? Because it's been a lot of work has been put into this over a very long period.
Yeah, well, originally there was 10 authorities given the choice by Cameron to vote for having an elected mayor. Nine areas said no. Bristol was the only one who said yes by 13% to 12% of the electorate who actually voted.
The amount a bit higher now, last night?
There was a higher turnout for getting rid of it, yeah. Still not high enough, unfortunately, but still.
Well, it never is it?
I mean, there you go. So basically, the unique feature of this, having the mayor onto this system, was that there'd be no chance to change your mind. Having tried an experiment, there was no way that Bristol would have been allowed to go back. So I got petitions together with colleagues, and basically we persuaded councillors in Bristol to support our call for there to be a right of a reversal.
Now, how easy was that to get that across party, or was it just Lib Dem councillors?
No, it wasn't just Lib Dem councillors. It was unanimous in the end, and fair play to him. George Ferguson actually voted for it as well, and he was the current mayor at the time. A lot of them actually voted for it, even though they weren't necessarily desperate to change the mayor at that time. So when Barbara Jank, my ex-colleague, actually got through the House of Lords an amendment which would have given Bristol a right to review, then basically the Tories were going to reverse that in the House of Commons. So I had to go up with support from councillors in Bristol to speak to Greg Clark, who was the community secretary at the time, to persuade him not to reverse the amendment, which, fair play, he didn't. So basically, he didn't think there was any way that we'd ever enact that right, but we have. If that hadn't been done, Bristol would never have had the chance to change its mind.
So the idea is it's been an experiment that hasn't worked. Why do you think it hasn't worked?
It's never a good idea to put all the power in one pair of hands. It really just does not work at all. We actually published in our local newsletter a list of reasons why it wasn't working. You don't get proper discussion before ideas are put into place. When something goes wrong with the mayor system, it's covered up. It's never looked at. It's never openly scrutinised.
Can you give us an example of that?
Well, Bristol Energy for several years, it just wasn't dealt with properly. The Kalinowski payoff, I mean, that was just absolutely shocking. There's a list of them, and I'll tell you what, there's probably quite a lot more that we haven't found out about yet.
Well, maybe that'll start coming out. It does seem to me that the way that under Ferguson, the previous mayor and the present mayor, Marvin Rees, there has been an increasing kind of corporatisation of it. So the idea is it's almost like you're running a business rather than running a council.
But running it very badly. I mean, any chief executive of an organisation that made the mess up that he made over the energy company would have been gone. But, I mean, although a lot of Labour councils were very frustrated about it, early days they voted against us having an inquiry. And it was only myself and a couple of others speaking to the council's independent auditors who got the full information out in the open.
So what happens now? We've still got 2 years of Marvin Rees as mayor, haven't we? So it just seems as if people would be thinking, well, what was the point of that?
Well, what we can do over the next couple of years, it's limited, but we can now speak to officers and say to them, look, you know, the public have given their view on what should be happening. We need things to change in the way that you support the administration and how you work with opposition councillors, and to try and make certain we get access to more information. And we do have a right to challenge. At the end of the day, stuff can be forced through by the mayor, but we can challenge and we can actually stand up to it.
Now, in 2016, when Marvin Rees took over as mayor, there was an enormous changes, particularly at the top amongst councillors, wasn't there? Council officers, the senior people. So presumably those are the sorts of people that he thought would be right to play things his way. Does that mean that in the future we're going to have to swap around and have people who have got more traditional public service experience back in as council officers, the senior ones?
Well, it's interesting that he had this massive big clear out, and we've spent millions on payoffs to people who've been got rid of, and the salaries have gone up through the roof, and frankly we haven't got anybody who's any better than was there before. The whole thing has got to change. The HR committee, and this is people from all that I was sitting on, from all parties, were furious about the way some of the things that were actually done. And we did manage to change a couple of things but Labour councillors there actually had to back us up.
One of the things that worries me more than anything else is this culture of secrecy. The idea that as ideas are being mulled over, that there is really no transparency to that at all. And the idea is that you're kind of confronted with a fait accompli. A really good example of that was this new plan for the so-called Western Harbour, which some people call, well, we in Bristol call it the Cumberland Basin, but somebody somewhere, some draftsman's office of a planning speculator or developer has decided to call it the Western Harbour. And of course, the local people were gobsmacked when that was revealed. So this just, I mean, what can be done about this over the next couple of years, Gary, to try and open up this secrecy a little bit?
Well, what I'm proposing to colleagues is that we speak to officers about bringing this stuff more out in the open and say that if stuff is actually pushed through Cabinet without there being proper examination and proper thought about it, that we do have a power which is called call-in. And basically that's a delaying tactic and get stuff out into the open for the public to see what's actually going on. And my own view is that we should be saying to officers, unless there's better advance information on stuff and better cross-party working, that we're going to be using that call-in facility a lot more than we have up to now.
Yeah, it's almost like you have to use some sort of slightly underhand tactic because the other side's not playing ball. Martin, I mean, this whole move from this concept of a public service over to a kind of corporatisation, I think is probably the most worrying thing about what we've seen with this US-style system over the last 8 years or so, 10 years in this now.
Well, I think whether you've got an elected mayor or a committee system, the challenges faced by local government, as we discussed with Estella Ticknell last week, are not going to go away. The reality is that there's been massive cuts in the budgets of local authorities, including Bristol, and this is not going to be a magic solution for, you know, the problems with property speculators, for example. They ain't going away either. That doesn't mean that I voted to revert to the system. I was one of those that voted in favour of changing the system, since I've been consistently against having mayors since George Ferguson, brassed his way into the role all those years ago. But I don't think that we can presume that the major challenges facing ordinary people, which are not often local anyway, you know, things like what happens with UC isn't decided by the local council, and that's the sort of thing that affects people.
This is universal credit.
Yeah, benefits. I mean, the sort of, you know, there's an... the emphasis upon local solutions to local problems. I realise that there is something to be said for that, but ultimately a lot of problems are not actually at the door of local authorities anyway.
Well, that's a very good argument, isn't it, Gary? So, you know, in a way, Marvin has just been having to cope with this withdrawal of support from Westminster. You know, that and that paints him in a bad light. It may not be anything to do with the system. It may just be that the Tory central government are taking money away from Bristol all the time.
Well, I think that central government not being generous, not just to Bristol, but to lots of other authorities.
That's right. It's a general problem. It's not just Bristol.
Yeah. But you've actually got to look at what the administration does with the money it's got. I mean, complaining you haven't got a bean to spend and then wasting £50 million on an energy company doesn't exactly, you know, give you any credibility. There's well over £1 million a year spent in his private office, and what actually happens is that every decision can't be made by normal offices. It's got to go up through his office, be churned around, and then comes back down again. It's slowing up decisions as well as costing a huge amount of money.
What about public toilets? I mean, this week we've had the announcement from central government that they're sending £300 million to Ukraine to help the army there to buy weapons, mercenaries or whatever. But we can't keep the public toilets open in Bristol.
Yeah, the problem is the sort of user shops or pubs or whatever, that's all right up to a certain point. But it can't possibly cover everything. And what should be happening and isn't happening is a proper open review of the areas where the service is not provided and public loo's been put in there. You don't need to put public loo's in everywhere in Bristol, but there are parts where the voluntary scheme doesn't work.
But also, I mean, shopping, places where there's shopping. The places like the Bear Pit here, which is, you know, a thoroughfare. People are crossing there on the way to and from work, to and from shopping. You know, these places which used to have, you know, loos. I don't want to bang on about it too much, but these public loos, surely we can keep these open in future, Gary, can we?
Well, there needs to be a fallback position.
Reopen them, I mean, really?
Well, some of the old ones probably weren't the easiest to run. But making certain that there's proper provision everywhere across the city is sensible. Very often that can be provided by private sector providers, but where it's not happening, then the council have got to be ready to step in.
Right. Anyway, so time to give our Mayor Marvin Rees, Labour Mayor Marvin Rees, his say. And he popped up. He doesn't return my calls and he won't be interviewed for this programme or by this programme or appear on it, other than the very first time he was, I think it was when he was maybe re-elected in 2016. I can't remember exactly when, but anyway, and then of course once he was elected he didn't come on again at all, and he only came on that program because every other candidate was on. He is someone who should be quite happy with the media, having worked up at the BBC himself for several years, and, you know, been to Harvard University, basically tapped up as a young man to be a global leader of tomorrow, a Yale World Fellow. And a big supporter of the World Economic Forum. So maybe we'll be seeing less of their policies being implemented by our 70 councillors rather than the one mayor. But let's have a listen to what Marvin Rees had to say earlier this week about the whole prospect of having a referendum over his position. Not him specifically, but the job that he fulfils as mayor.
From the council chamber, the man re-elected to be mayor last year and who will step down in 2 years' time is angry the referendum, triggered by a majority of 17 councillors, is even happening.
I think it's the wrong thing to spend £700,000 of Bristol taxpayers' money on at this time. We should be focusing on the challenges facing Bristol. And the mayoral system was up for judgment last summer. There was a mayoral election. Two of the candidates ran on a scrap the mayor and didn't do very well. We have had this question in the public domain.
Gary?
Well, I mean, he was actually claiming that the Greens candidate was in favour of having the mayor. Now, the individual candidate, they might have been, but the Green Party have just demonstrated in spades that they didn't approve of it. So the vast majority of people, even in that election, were not voting for parties which were in favour of having a mayor system. And it's democracy. apart from anything else, a lot of people actually voted for the mayor in the first place. They didn't know what was going to be got because the information was poor. But on top of that, since then, we've had the Metro Mayor. Ignoring what people think about the chap as an individual, government have devolved a little bit of power to him. He's in a position to take the strategic decisions, and the councils in the area should work together through that post to actually get stuff for the area. And so, you know, the position has changed.
So one of the things George Ferguson pointed out on this programme last week was because it's a bit weird, isn't it, having these two mayors, one kind of superimposed on top of the other one, and it's a bit difficult to see them and get them in focus sometimes when there's two like that. Richard Payne at ITV talked to Dan Norris as well, but I mean the point here is surely that why have we come to this sort of situation? Discussing this with Estella Ticknell last week, it was almost as we were saying, well, I mean, is this like almost like deliberate confusion? Because it doesn't seem to make any sense. It's almost as if these jobs have come along because someone thought they were a good idea at the time, but there's actually no strategic thinking.
Well, there's a need for strategic for the four authorities in the area that used to be Avon to work together. And they were working together quite effectively for a few years, although that didn't happen in a distant past, I know, because they need to cooperate on transport issues and all that sort of stuff to work together. Now, whether you do that through having a Metro Mayor or not is open to question. But having said that, the Metro Mayor does not have the complete unchecked power that the Bristol Mayor position was actually given. He has to work with the leaders of the authorities. So basically, he's more of a chair rather than a dictator.
Yeah. This word dictator was used before the mayor system came along in the campaign, and some people were saying, Gary, do you think, I mean, it's a very strong word to use about someone who's been elected, but would you still use it?
Yes, I would, in the way that the power has actually been used in Bristol, yes.
Because it is, Martin, it's a strong word, isn't it, dictator? But, I mean, it does give Marvin absolute power, really.
Well, that was the idea behind the mayoral system, which is why I was opposed to it in the first place. And, of course, the idea was that they would have all this power to get things done, whatever that was, whatever that meant. And, of course, that often means then, because of the cuts in central government funding, that means doing prestige projects, for example, because you've got nothing else to spend your time on, because what you should be doing you can't do because you haven't got the resources. And then, you know, ultimately, that the idea was that they would then go to the electorate, it would be yay or nay, you liked it or you didn't. And, you know, we had an election last year which the Greens came close to toppling Marvin. I think the crucial thing has been the Greens deciding that they wanted to get rid of the mayoral system because they're the rising force in Bristol politics.
Well, that's interesting because the Greens are a little bit more collegiate than some of the other parties. Sandy Hall Riven, who was their candidate, he was very much for the mayor system. And I noticed today, this morning, after the result, he came up saying, well, okay, fine, you know, I'm happy to go along with this. I've changed my mind now. Let's go with what the people want, which is either he's unprincipled or he's just a practical person that really does. What do you think, Gary? It's interesting. I thought it was interesting to see him do this kind of swerve this morning.
Well, he's not really all that relevant, is he?
Well, he may be. I mean,
well, he didn't get elected as the mayor. Like, is he a councillor?
No.
Well, therefore, he's just a person.
Yeah. Yes, okay, fair enough.
I mean, basically, when the first vote was put in front of the council back in March the previous year, the Greens were all over the place. They didn't know what they were doing. They weren't coherent as a party. And basically that's why the vote was lost, despite the fact that several Labour councillors actually supported call for the referendum at the time. But this time, having increased their number of seats, they were coherent and operated as a party. Now, interestingly, a third of them actually would have preferred the leader and cabinet system rather than the committee system that we've got. But they said, all right, well, whichever is put in front of us to get rid of the mayor, we'll vote for it. And they were unanimous on that. And that's unusual for the Green Party, because very often they split in all sorts of different ways.
So let's have a listen now to the Metro Mayor. His name's Dan Norris. I think it was near Sedgemoor MP, Martin, for the Labour Party.
I don't know if it was Sedgemoor, was it?
North East Somerset.
North East Somerset. Wansdyke, that's it. It was the previous, it was Jacob Rees-Mogg's constituency anyway. And he was a, wasn't it?
Yeah, he stood against Jacob Rees-Mogg, didn't he? But he never.
He was the MP there for a while.
Yeah. Rees-Mogg hoofed him out when he was an MP. But anyway, he's now the Metro Mayor. I think before we hear from Dan, can you just explain a little bit more to us? And I'd love to say I understood what the Metro Mayor does. I can't even see why a mayor has much of a role in transport, because transport is basically run and organised for the most part by these private companies anyway.
Well, that's what's got to change.
Well,
basically, the Metro Mayor, as they're doing in Manchester, needs to set up a franchising system. At the moment, what happens is the private companies cream the money off the profitable routes and then put the begging bowl out for some of the other routes. Otherwise, they cut them out completely. Instead of doing that, there should be a proper franchise system where the authority says, you want to run these routes, you pay for it.
So there's a bit of research done by the authority as to where people need to move from A to B, and basically to tell the private transport companies, right, if you're going to run a bus service, it's got to be here.
Yes, the franchising allows, it's a system they've got in London, basically, allows the authority to decide maximum fares, frequency and routes. And basically, after that, it's up to the companies to bid to have those routes and to run them in the most efficient way that they can.
Well, let's hear from our glorious Metro Mayor then, the mayor that isn't going to be disappearing in 2 years' time.
Well,
we've had a system in the past that has seen us fall behind other regions, and that gap is closing, and I hope that we'll soon see it with rocket boosters on, with us leading the way nationally on so many important areas, which we've started to do, actually, in Bristol and in the west of England. So I think it's a better system. You don't have to be an expert in it to know whether one system's better than the other. And I hope people will just spend a little bit of time, despite all their concerns, to think about this carefully and then vote for a mayor to continue in Bristol.
So that's the Metro Mayor, Dan Norris. He's talking it up, Gary, saying it's already starting, it's going to be great, it's going to be rocket boosters underneath it. What does he mean?
He means he wants to say things that people think are impressive. I mean, really, the cooperation at that level with the councils together, although Marvin Rees managed to block North Somerset coming into the team fully, which was quite
disgraceful. I thought North Somerset declined to get involved. I thought that was...
Originally, the previous administration in North Somerset, they had a row with George Ferguson over transport matters, and the Conservative administration there, therefore, refused to join the combined authority as a result of that. They got voted out, and the new administration, which is a combination of independents and some Liberal Democrats, are desperately trying to get in. It's logical for them to be involved in the process, and Marvin blocked them.
OK, so a big question, which I wasn't expecting this morning, looking on my... I'm not allowed to look on Facebook because the glorious Zuckerberg has blocked me from having anything to do with Facebook during the duration of this election, as if I could have any real influence on it. It was very... I mean, in fact, I take it as a bit of a compliment that they bother to block me, as they did back in 2021 during the local elections then. The whole point of this, Gary, has got to be to... You know, to let the people do what they want to do, isn't it? I mean, that's ultimately what this. What do you think we're going to see on the ground? I suppose that's what I'm trying to get at. What are we going to see the differences in the next, you know, six, eight months?
I hope that we're going to see officers responding more effectively to the wide range of councillors that we've got in the council, making information more available, and therefore them being more influenced in more areas on the way that the council actually does things.
Well, you've got your fingers crossed. That's probably not going to happen, is it? Whilst he can, he's going to keep a lid on things, old Marvin.
Well, he's going to do his best to do that. But don't forget, the officers that work for the council actually have a huge amount of power. Now, they know that in 2 years' time, they're going to be working under a very different administration altogether. They're going to have to work with the councillors, a lot of whom are there now. So I think there's going to be probably more cooperation between officers and councillors than there has been over the last few years.
Well, I mean, I was getting a lot of messages this morning, as I was saying, about London. Now, Londoners looking jealously at Bristol, 110 110, 120 miles west of them, saying, oh, if only we could get rid of the mayor in London. It was so much better before we had a London mayor. Do you think there's any prospect for Londoners to go back to the old committee system that they used to have before they had a mayor?
Well, it's a completely different situation. The mayor in London does not run all the details of a council. He's an overseer working with all the councils. And the councils are run in a normal way, just as Bristol will be from now on. So, the Bristol mayor was in an anachronous ridiculous position of having control of every detail of how a council actually run. The London mayor doesn't do that.
So what about the other mayors that we know about, the Birmingham, Manchester? Are those systems the same as Bristol or London?
No, they're the same as London. And in Manchester, etc.
This is so anachronistic. You're quite right. Why on earth did this happen in Bristol?
Because we were daft enough to vote for it. by a very small margin. And basically a lot of false information was actually given. And actually, local media in Bristol had a fair amount to do with that.
Well, this figurehead mayor idea is definitely a US-style thing, and it doesn't really strike me as the way we normally do things. The idea is, and a lot of people have suggested this, that when you're electing 70 councillors from across the city, what you've got there is a pool from which you can put together an administration. And it's much better to do that than it is actually in... the idea of having a figurehead... It's almost like you've got Martin. It's almost like it's this kind of celebrity running the show, rather than someone who's kind of worked their way up from being a councillor to getting the respect of their group, becoming part of the leading group in the city, and then being elected from amongst their own councillors.
Well, when we were first talking about having a mayor in Bristol, I believe people like Carol Vorderman were thinking of putting themselves forward. And, when you're talking about celebrity status, this is... And, of course, the other thing about having a mayor in this time of... fiscal austerity is that they've got to go for gimmicks, because running the actual council is actually lots of really unpleasant, difficult decisions. I think if you think back to it, London, when it was run by the GLC, when I used to live there, when Ken Livingstone was first not the mayor, he was the leader of the council. But of course, it was a Labour administration answerable to the Labour Party. And of course, what's going to happen in Bristol is we're going to see at the next elections, when they happen, all-out elections, is you're going to have a very split vote in the Labour Party and the Green Party. The Greens coming up, the Labour Party, on the back foot. But there'll probably have to be some kind of coalition between those parties to run the city. Now, that is actually what... And then the decisions will have to be taken about what we're going to cut, because unless we change the national government, that's what we're going to be discussing. And I think the Greens are going to find it a bit more challenging than they imagine when they've got to make the nasty decisions.
But I'm a bit of a nostalgist for things like the Greater London Council. It seems pretty clear to me that the Conservatives, they got rid of that because it was actually representing Londoners and a challenge to Tory rule at the time.
Well, of course, the other thing was that the GLC, because it had control of the business rate, as Livingstone pointed out at the time, I can put a half p rate on the City of London, and that gives me a massive amount of money to spend in the boroughs. And, that's exactly why the Tory government got rid of it. And then, of course, they brought in elected mayors. There was a period when they didn't have any government over London at all, apart from the boroughs. Then they brought in elected mayors, and, of course, elected mayors were then grafted into the British system at that point. And, of course, ultimately Boris Johnson became the elected mayor. And look at what a great success that's all turned out to be.
Well, the Fair's Fair in the 1980s, under the Greater London Council, would have been a revolution, wouldn't it, in transport? In fact, it's the sort of thing that you could imagine these Extinction Rebellion people chaining themselves or gluing themselves to the road service to try and make it happen. But it was actually nearly brought about through Ken Livingstone and the elected Labour administration in London.
What happened with
that? The idea being to make public transport in London free.
Not ultimately free, but it was basically a pound a fare to go anywhere.
Wanted to move towards.
What happened with that, even before the abolition of the GLC, was that the House of Lords struck it down. They said it was illegal for the GLC to bring in the Fair's Fair policy because they had to balance the books on transport, which in fact is rubbish. Plenty of cities all over the world, including in Britain, they subsidise public transport.
Well, but we do here, don't we, Gary?
That's right.
Well, yes, but not in an efficient way.
No, well, I mean, and in any case, it was an entirely politicised decision by the House of Lords peers, you know, to basically frustrate the policy. Mm. And then, of course, they knew that Livingston could win democratic elections in London, so they abolished the authority. Then, of course, when they had the election, when they re-established the authority, there was going to be an elected mayor, and Livingston's always been against elected mayors. I think that's still his position, for the reasons that you otherwise would share.
I think he and Ferguson have probably got quite a lot in common, mayors themselves that are against themselves.
Well, yeah, but I mean, Livingston's been consistent about this over the years. He stood in the end, because if there's going to be... there is a system. The Labour Party's always had a policy that it will fight every democratic election. Now, I don't know whether that's a good or a bad policy, but that has always been the policy, that we'll always put a candidate up in anything where there's a vote. So, anyway, Frank Dobson was chosen by the Labour Party to be the candidate, and Livingston, because of his local contacts, was able to stand as an independent, defeat Dobson, and then, of course, Tony Blair had to invite Livingston back into the Labour Party and eat a humble pie. But you can see in a big city like London...
But he got him in the end.
Yeah, in a big city like London... You know, you can see that these things, you know, it's a different level. I mean, there are more voters in London, for example, than in the whole of Ireland. You know, it's a big decision who runs it.
So what about the background to all of this, which we've been discussing generally, which is the cuts? I mean, what's going on, Gary, it seems to me, is almost reducing the role of local authorities, our elected councillors here at City Hall, to zero almost. But so it's almost as if the mayor has been there for a while. We're now bringing back the councillors, but the budget is the money that we're getting to spend from central government is shrinking the whole time.
Yeah, but in actual fact, it's not a matter of asking for more handouts from central government. What should be happening is more powers given to local authorities to actually raise their own finances. I mean, what is the point in us going up with a begging bowl? That hands the power across the central government.
Well, you're not going to make yourself popular with Bristolians if you just introduce more taxes, are you?
Well, we wouldn't have more taxes. Basically, at the moment, we pay money up to London, and then it comes back down again. In the meantime, you know, lots of it is creamed off.
Well, money's paid out by people in their taxes, PAYE or whatever, and that goes to central government and then distributed to local authorities.
You know what, this reminds me of what happened in Ukraine after the coup, is there was a big change around where the Kiev government started keeping much more of the national tax revenue for themselves and spreading much less out amongst the regions of the country. So this is a tendency, isn't it? Well, it's going on all over the place. For central government to try and keep all the money for themselves and starve the regions.
Well, you've got the struggle is actually because of, you know, the resources are being reduced because of policy, you know, decisions that have been made decades ago have now brought us in, you know, you wouldn't want to start from here, really. But of course, central government when we used to have the rates system and business rates, which gave local authorities a fairly solid chunk of money to call on, as I mentioned earlier with the JLC, the business rate, because business rates were taken away from local authorities. Are they back now?
Partly,
yeah. I mean, all of this is actually above the heads of the ordinary punters.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I'm not saying that it isn't important, but, you know, you need the underlying tendency has been for wealthy areas of the country to be cosseted. We've seen this throughout the Tory regime, you know, where Knowsley in Liverpool has had the most cuts per head, East Dorset the least, in fact a little uplift, and that is because ultimately it's about a struggle between those with wealth and power and those without, and councils are part of that.
And Britain is the most centralised administration in Europe.
Yeah.
In most European countries, the regional or semi-regional, you know, authorities have considerably more power, and they raise their own finances.
I suppose you could also put
taxes in places and
put a lot of this down to 2008, Martin, the bailouts, you know, because the governments have just simply ceded a lot of their power to the banks by going in so much debt.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's another question about, you know, what's going on in the global macroeconomy and the national macroeconomy.
Well, what do you make of the increase in interest rates? They did it basically in parallel in the US, in Wall Street and the city this week.
Well, that's what generally tends to happen. What's going on now is because of the inflation spike caused by various things, you know, the Ukraine war.
Excuse me, I keep hearing that on the press. It's caused by the Ukraine war. No, it's caused by our sanctions on Russia.
Okay, well, that's part of the Ukraine war. Well, okay, I was using that as...
It's not. it's not the Ukraine war. We have decided to sanction Russia, and therefore we have caused...
It's not just that. Apart from anything else, it's huge amounts of farmland that used to produce produce we use in this country is now not being farmed, and we're not getting the produce. Well, that's one of the reasons for increasing prices.
Yes, and also, of course, there is an inflation effect of Brexit. That's just a fact.
Absolutely. Well,
what about this 50 billion from Shell and BP? Record profits. I mean, this is they release their profits quarterly, but if you add them together and look at their annual profits, 50 billion profits. It's way above anything they've ever had before. And that's largely because tail end of last year, autumn, fuel prices went right up. And we were told that gas prices are going up. Now, these fuel companies, and this surely is the main reason why we're starting to really get inflation, is because when you start taxing, when diesel prices go up, the price of everything goes up.
It's one of the factors. There's a number of factors why we've got inflation. And basically, windfall tax on the companies would be fine.
Yeah.
Because it's a short-term situation. You put short-term tax on and use it for something beneficial.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you might want to have a nationalised energy infrastructure, which is what we used to have. And that's, of course, part of the problem, is that we've actually done very stupid things in this country over many decades. You know, elected mayors are rather minor one of the, in the big scheme of things.
Yeah, pretty major in Bristol, I can tell you.
Well, I jumped on to, I think it was Tuesday or something, just jumped on to talk radio to try and make the point about, you know, energy prices. And it's just so frustrating to see we've got here a little graphic from the Daily Mail a few weeks ago, or a couple of weeks ago. Fuel cost rises see 20% go. 26% go without heating. People just now having to think, well, I better not put the heating on because you just don't have the money to do it. And then this week I noticed too, Boris announcing that the benefits, Martin, won't go up in line with inflation. Well, the benefits are a subsistence, the minimum people need to live on.
Yes, and of course, ultimately, this is an interesting point where the Chancellor has got to make a decision. And of course, some of it is out of his hands because the Bank of England will make the decision. But we're going to have a spike in inflation, probably followed by a recession, which could turn into a global depression. And then we really are going to be fighting over the crumbs.
The country is in a mess financially. And basically, one of the problems about inflation is inflation breeds inflation. So naturally, people, when they've got increased prices to pay, they want bigger wage increases, and there's a spiral that builds up.
Well, I think there's less chance of that in the current circumstances because people haven't got the power to bid up their wages in the way they used to have.
I noticed,
which
Boris,
is why you're going to get a deflationary effect.
There's a shortage of labour, mainly due to Brexit, but that means that the bargaining power that individuals have got is a bit better than it.
Than it used to be, but I don't. I would argue that the Bank of England shouldn't raise interest rates like Danny Blanchfield. Farrow used to be a Bank of England person, but he's now an academic. But the insiders in the Bank of England, Rishi Sunak will be listening to them, is if we don't raise interest rates, then inflation will take hold. The danger is by slamming on the brakes, you actually crash the economy.
People have got,
and then you're actually in a worse situation.
On cheap money now. Suddenly they're going to have to pay more, but they'll have less income to pay.
Well, what will happen is that the property market will go. That's what will happen.
I noticed Boris said this week, and really I was fuming because I thought this is just nonsense. He was saying, well, we can't put benefits up because that would increase inflation.
Well, we can't put benefits up because that would increase public expenditure. There's nothing wrong with increasing public expenditure as long as you don't just print the money. You've got to raise taxes on wealthy people. Don't say it too loud.
And we have a proroguing of Parliament this week, so no Prime Minister's questions. Martin would be pleased about that. I was quite disappointed. But instead we got Susanna Reid from Good Morning Britain, gave Boris a bit of a grilling. I think it was on Monday or Tuesday, where the subject of Ukraine came up.
Well, I'm very proud of our diplomats in Kyiv and Melinda Simmons, who's going back to reopen the embassy. She's done an absolutely amazing job, and I think anybody who targets UK diplomats is totally beyond the pale. They have no justification for it. Let me tell you why they have no justification, Susanna. What the UK is doing and has done since the crisis began is lead the world in helping the Ukrainians to protect themselves against wanton aggression, barbaric aggression by Vladimir Putin. That's all we're doing. And it's very important for people to understand the limits of what we're saying. We're not saying that we're doing this in order to drive some geopolitical change or to have an outcome in Moscow. I think the UK is indifferent on all that. What we care about is Ukrainian people and their suffering.
Okay.
And it is totally unjustifiable to allow a free, sovereign, independent country like Ukraine just to be overwhelmed and obliterated as it might have been. So what we did was we began very early on, earlier than any other European country, to send them the weaponry that they might need against against tanks in particular, then, of course, many yep. other types of weapons.
But we
also marshalled the world, or helped to marshal the world, in delivering a very tough package of economic yep. sanctions.
So that's Good Morning Britain, Susanna Reid. Quite an interesting interview. I'll put a copy of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk for all you nerds out there that really want to hear the whole thing. But I thought she did quite a good job, actually, in grilling Boris. Martin, what do you make of his analysis of what's going on in Ukraine there? He's really talking about a story earlier this week, which was saying that the Kremlin could target UK diplomats with bombs as they return to Kiev following the failed siege of Kiev by Russia after they withdrew.
Who said that they would do that?
Well, apparently Moscow has. That's according to the Daily Mail and Boris.
Well, I don't think I've seen anything from the Russian Ministry of Defence suggesting any such thing. Well, I mean, the stuff about we're not interested in geopolitics. Liz Truss's speech to the Mansion House last week was all about the geopolitics, and we're going to have a global NATO. We're going to have to fight in the South China Sea. We're going to have to fight the Russians. We're going to have a new Marshall Plan. Amazing, the whole new Marshall Plan, the billions of dollars that were spent to rebuild Europe after World War II. And I feel like saying, Rishi, get your checkbook out. New Marshall Plan, World War rationing, of course. There have to be rationing. We're going to have a World War. I think the free market philosophy has gone down the drain. You know, there's all sorts of implications of this, isn't
there? What about the Russians? I mean, the Russians were beaten in Kiev, weren't they?
No, they withdrew from Kiev because they made an agreement at Istanbul to withdraw. So that's why they withdrew. In actual fact, they don't want Kiev. What they want is the Russian-speaking zones which voted to leave the Ukraine in 2014 as part of the Russian Federation. And that's what the war's about, just like the war in Kosovo was about whether Serbia was going to be in control of Kosovo or not. And eventually NATO said, no, you're not, after a 78-day bombing campaign. That's the precedent.
Anyway, Ukraine is certainly dominating the London media, Gary. Is it justified to be, do you think?
Well, it is very important. It affects what happens in Europe, and of course it affects us quite dramatically. So paying attention to what's going on is pretty important.
So how does it affect us then? I mean, apart from us having to take refugees, us having to pay to support the Ukrainian army?
Well, apart from anything else, Ukraine is a major source of a number of different products, you know. Our grocery industry.
Grain, for example.
Yeah, exactly, yes. And the price of that has just rocketed. So, you know, it will have a big effect. If trade volumes and paths are interrupted, as they have been by this war.
Do you think people in Knoll think much about this, care much about it? Or is this, you know, there are other issues more important to them?
I think there's general sympathy for the Ukrainian people. I don't think there's an awful lot of attention to the detail of the politics. People in Knoll actually care more about what's happening to their swimming pool, as an example, you know? I mean, that's a big issue for them. There's a controversial new plan for the redevelopment of our shopping centre, which, you know, interests an awful lot of people. And, you know, there's more people paying attention to that than international politics.
Well, that's exactly what Susanna Reid points out to, well, she believes, to Boris Johnson in our second extract from this interview from the Good Morning Britain presenter Susanna Reid, where she talks to Boris and grills him now on the cost of living.
The biggest issue for people is not Ukraine. The biggest issue for people right now is how they can possibly sure. afford to pay their bills. And I want to ask you then about a number of our viewers who have got in touch with us about the choices that they're making. Elsie is 77. She's a widow and she's a pensioner who lives in a council house. She receives a pension of £170 a week. Her energy bills have gone, get this, from £17 a month to £85 a month.
Yeah.
She will pay an additional £816 a year. To cut down on spending, Prime Minister, Elsie has now resorted to eating one meal a day. She's 77 years old. She's losing weight. She goes to the supermarket at the end of the day to buy yellow sticker discounted items. She gets up early in the morning to use her Freedom bus pass to stay on buses all day to avoid using energy at home. What else should Elsie cut back on, in your opinion?
Well, I don't want Elsie to cut back on anything. Let's talk about Elsie and what we're doing. And I just remind you that the 24-hour Freedom bus pass was something that I actually introduced, just parenthetically.
Marvellous. So Elsie should be grateful to you for her bus pass. But what else should she cut back on?
There are plenty of things we are doing. So what we want to do is make sure that we have people who are in particular hardship looked after by their councils. Mm-hmm. So we're putting much more money into local councils. We have the particular payments to help elderly people in particular with the cost of heating. But look, Susanna,
she already qualifies for that.
And I'm going to accept.
I'm asking you now, what does Elsie cut back on now?
I don't want Elsie to have to cut back on anything. And we will make sure.
But Prime Minister, her energy bills have gone up to £85 a month.
And the best answer is to help her abate the cost of energy as we are, but also.
What, through a loan that she has to pay back?
To make sure. There's a direct cut in her council tax as a result of what we're doing, plus the
she doesn't
the
qualify
home,
for the council the tax rebate allowance, as her home
plus
comes
the winter
under
fuel allowance. There are measures that we put in place to help people, but I'm not going to pretend
you
can't
say anything
Susanna,
to help
I'm not going to pretend
to
see, no, because what we are doing is making sure that we take the steps now to invest in our energy supply. You'll get back to your point about the energy companies, to ensure that we have the supply for the medium and the long term.
Elsie and people like Elsie doesn't help. Taking VAT off energy bills might help people. The windfall tax on energy companies might help people. I've got another example for you. Dan and his wife made you parents, full-time carers of two disabled daughters. One is severely disabled, cerebral palsy, brain damage, deaf and partially blind. My heart goes out to this family. For her treatment and to keep her comfortable, the family have a range of different electrical machines used on a daily basis, some of them 24 hours a day, which means their energy bills are, of course, high. Their energy bills have gone up to £450 a month. What should Dan and Maju cut back on?
We are looking at particular arrangements to support those who may be using dialysis machines or who may have particular high requirements of electricity because of their medical conditions. And I totally understand that hardship. But just to get back to my point, I know that this may sound frustrating because people think, we need money now. Well, the money we have is all...
These families need money now.
They do. And we are doing everything we can to help them. But
okay,
You've
said that a number of times, Prime Minister, and I have to take issue because you've said we're doing everything we can, and
if
yet you've
if you put
said
a windfall
do more.
Tax... Let's just go back to your suggestions. If you put a windfall tax on the energy companies, what that means is that you discourage them from making the investments that we want to see that will, in the end, keep energy prices lower for everybody.
What do you make of that, Gary? So much in there, but he's saying that there's actually more money coming to local authorities.
Well, some of the temporary funding during the pandemic was actually half reasonable. You know, not perfect, but it was better than people actually thought. With regard to the energy companies, I mean, the ludicrous thing is the excuse is they're going to invest in renewable energy. Well, some of them will do. But all you've got to do is to say that the investment that they're making in renewables, which is what we need in the long term from these companies, negates the tax. So basically, they can claim a 100% allowance against their profits if they put the money into there. And then they won't suffer the windfall tax, will they? and we get what we want. But at the moment, I'm afraid, you know, it is a fluke circumstance where their profits have gone up through the roof. Temporarily, we need to take some of that money and use it effectively.
Well, I'm not sure it's temporary. It looks to me as if the hike in diesel and petrol prices is a, you know, permanent a boon for the oil companies, that they're raking it in because they're actually far more powerful than Boris. They seem to say to him, well, we want to make more money, you're going to have to do this, and if you try and stop us, then we'll simply fail to do any investment.
Well, I mean, basically, if it does last longer, they got taxed for longer. If it's short-lived, which in actual fact it should be, you know, a year or two, then basically that's the period that they'll get taxed for. And as soon as their profits start to drop, that'll coincide with the cost of people's fuel bills coming down.
Well, that's right. But pretty shocking what we heard about the lady there, Martin. Her monthly bill going up from £17 to £85. That's something like 400-500% increase. I mean, how are people supposed to cope with things like that?
Well, the simple answer is they can't, and it's going to lead to things ultimately like homelessness because people can't pay the rents and so on. It's obviously people on lower incomes who are going to feel this the worst. You know, during the pandemic, people on higher incomes managed to save quite a lot. It's the obvious thing to do in the short run is the windfall tax on the oil companies, and of course Rishi Sunak has suggested that he might consider doing that. Now, if the Tories...
Was that when suddenly there was a whole load of stuff about his wife appeared in the newspaper?
Yes, well,
even think about it, Rishi?
Well, you see, in the old days before Thatcher came along, the Tory party would have jumped at that because it's just an obvious thing to do. And they could just steal the Lib Dem Labour clothes and just say, we're going to do that. So you don't need to vote for them to do that because we're going to do it anyway. And there was a sort of robust attitude towards... You know, things like this, even just pragmatic, you know, this is the sort of thing that is going to win us votes, let's do it. And it may well be in the end that if the Boris is eventually booted out and they get a new leader, that they may do something like that in order to try and win the next election. But by that stage, it'll be far too late for many people. And it's criminal, really, that we've got this minority government, which is what it is. I mean, most people, if you actually ask them, should we tax the energy companies to keep people's bills down, the answer would be yes, wouldn't it?
Well, countries around the world are looking at Britain in amazement as they see that millions of people in this country who are actually relying, as we heard from Estella Ticknell last week, on food banks. And in fact, there's a whole massive infrastructure of these food banks has had to, which is basically charitable donations of food, which has had to grow up around it. Now, this is not just people who are unemployed, Martin, or disabled and cannot get an income. It's also the working poor. I mean, you're talking about something like the bottom fifth or so of people in middle low income jobs have to go to a food bank every week to get their food for free.
Yes, and it's partly because their rents are so ridiculous because of the way the property market works in this country. This country is a racket run by the insiders, the people with existing wealth, and they run it in their interests. Well, and that's why we end up where we end up. And, you know, look at France, for example. You've got a nationalised energy company, and they can just say, right, well, you're not going to take loads of profits because we're just going to prevent you from doing that. Although, even if they were making the profits, as in Norway, and the Statoil, that goes straight into the government's coffers. So what we've done in this country is, by privatising everything, including the energy infrastructure, we've left ourselves at the mercy of corporate predators.
Well, there's so many food banks in Bristol that we have now got something called a Fair Share Food Bank Warehouse, which is a whole warehouse full, which is where the food production companies take their surplus stuff there, and then it gets distributed out around the city to the various food banks. Because this is a massive infrastructure, and this week we heard that the South West has got a second Fair Share Food Bank Warehouse. I suppose this is a growth industry, isn't it? Handing out free handouts of food to people that can't afford food anymore has been open in Plymouth. And here is Charlotte Gay from ITV West reporting on it.
Free food that's brought in by the ton and shared out crate by crate. That's what Fair Share's been doing for years in Bristol, and now it's Plymouth's turn for a food distribution warehouse.
This has been 4 years of really hard work to get us here, so We started off working in the pandemic in particular, getting emergency food out to communities across Devon and across Cornwall. But that was only ever going to be temporary. What this warehouse here in Plymouth represents is a long-term commitment from Fairshare.
The food distribution charity shares its supply with a lot of local food banks and community groups who are here today to celebrate its grand opening. But the plan and the need to deliver a million meals in Devon and Cornwall by the end of the year is much more sobering.
Food insecurity was already a big issue. I think what the pandemic's done, and obviously now the cost of living crisis has done, is put people who were not in a very good position in an even worse position. So we have a really good bird's eye view across the kind of food poverty picture in the region, and it has just got so much worse.
So best before July this summer, that's plenty of time for most of us to get through a pack of cereal. But for supermarkets, this is not a long enough shelf life, and that's why they donate their food by the pallet load.
Local fresh food suppliers have also seen the need and want to do their bit to help as well.
We're supplying up to 5,000 meals a week now, with the hope that we're going to be supplying some more going forward. And we're looking to develop new products, and we're supplying into both depots now, Plymouth and Bristol. So the Plymouth depot is perfect for us because we're just down the road.
Having the warehouse on the Devon and Cornwall border means more food can be delivered to the remote parts of the southwest. With the first stop on today's round at Shakespeare's Primary School, who takes a delivery every Thursday to help up to 50 families. And Deputy Head Teacher Bex Radford says these top-ups at the end of the week take away the worry of a nearly empty fridge.
The children and the parents pop into the Shakespeare shop. It's free of charge. Children love coming in with a carrier bag and just picking up the things that they are keen to have in their evening meal or their packed lunch. The parents work really hard for their children, doing a really great job. And if we can help them by supporting them and our school community, that's what we're aiming to do.
Back on the road, and the Fair Share van heads down into Cornwall to help anyone, anywhere, keep food on the table. Charlotte Gay, ITV News, Plymouth.
Well, there's a little snapshot there, but this is becoming, actually, it's horrible to say, a growth industry, isn't it? And they're actually having to build these larger warehouses now to keep so much food to supply people who can't afford to buy it.
It's unfortunately becoming normal, and that's not good for the people who have to rely on this, because they want the right to be able to work and to earn enough to actually be to look after themselves. And people generally do not like having charity applied to them. They prefer to be more in control. And it's people, as you say, in lots of cases, who are working, who are doing their very best, and they're forced into food banks.
So having a job is no longer a way out of poverty?
In some cases, it's not.
Martin?
No, I mean, there's... The changes in the labour market over my lifetime have completely disempowered large sections of the population.
You talked about rent just now, didn't you? I mean, that's playing a large part here, isn't it? Because much of the people's money is that they earn is going on rent.
Yeah, well, if you think back to the pre-Thatcher era, rent was relatively low compared to what it is now. So people... You know, that they could manage to feed themselves fairly adequately with a relatively limited amount of money. But rent, you've got to keep a roof over your head.
But we're something like you're on the road to disaster. We're something like the fourth richest country in the world.
Well, I don't know if we're the fourth richest, but there's plenty of resources. They're just very badly distributed. And what we've had over many decades is, as I said earlier, the insider groups who benefit from property bubbles, who invest in the stock market, who run the country and run it in their interests. And that's why ordinary people, especially at the bottom of the pile, have had to suck all this up.
So just looking at the... we are one of the 10 richest countries in the world, apparently. But so it seems to me that what's happening is that the wealth is not going from the wealthy to the poor at all anymore. Well, that was a whole sort of basic thing. Post-World War II settlement was that everybody is going to have enough to survival, and now it seems pretty clear that, for example, even basic things like buying food, there is no, the government isn't going to make sure that you have it. It's going to be left to charities and churches.
Yes, and it's even, I mean, when they're speaking amongst themselves, you will find, you know, Tory activists and MPs actually think this is a good thing. You know, charity is good, better than the government, you know, giving you what is yours of right. Yeah. The way our benefit system now works, UC is the only benefit for people who lose their jobs. Previously, we used to have unemployment benefit. Now, unemployment benefit was, in theory, an insurance system. So you pay in while you're in work, and then you can claim the money as unemployment benefit until it runs.
Didn't it used to be called Social Security?
Indeed. But, I mean, I'm talking about your unemployment benefit. I mean, in Germany and places like this, your unemployment benefit, if you're put out of work, is 80% of your previous salary, and it's based on an insurance principle that you've paid in, and you can draw, and you're not put under any pressure to look for work. That's up to you. You can also just say, well, I'm not looking for work at the moment. I'm just going to live on my unemployment benefit, which I have paid into all those years. But what with UC is a system designed to catch the very poorest and only them, but you can find having a lifetime of work and get made redundant at 55 that you're forced to live on a very, very low income indeed, and you can't pay your rent or your mortgage or whatever it is, and so on. And, this is the model of the economy which people like Jacob Rees-Mogg have, wanted for years and years.
Well,
hang on, it's
not just Jacob Rees-Mogg, Martin, is it? Because the Blair government and the Brown government didn't do anything to change it.
Well, the problem with them is that they bought into all of this, or at least half of it. And, of course, the Liberal Democrats, by going to coalition with the Tories, also bought into it. Now, we've actually moved very far away from what used to be a consensus kind of politics. I mean, in the past, as we said earlier, Tory governments wouldn't have thought twice about putting a windfall tax on the energy companies that had just done it. Edward Heath would have just said, yeah, do it. That's all gone.
Anyway, the Tories, it's just to take a step back from the Bristol situation, which we've covered pretty thoroughly, I hope. Haven't we? No, is anything we missed, Gary?
There's another
level. We're only on here
level,
for an hour.
Level of dungeons to go, We're only on level three.
Because if there's anything else we want to talk about what you think's going on here in the city, you're more than welcome. But I'm just thought we ought to have a look at the national situation. It's been extremely bad for the Conservatives overnight. Called by Sky, it used to be owned by Rupert Murdoch, now isn't. A tough night for the Conservatives as Labour makes modest gains but wins symbolic seats. So Keir Starmer celebrates, although he's just being prosecuted for some sort of party, a bit like party.
He's being investigated.
All right, okay. Well, he thought he got away with it, but then the police have changed their mind. I mean, this sounds ridiculous.
But the Daily Mail, the Daily Mail
down the line.
We'll definitely have something to do about that.
So it's been a tough night, so Sky say. Plus, by the way, there's a little thing here saying why you can trust Sky News. Listen, we make our own minds up about whether we trust what we see from you London media people. Thank you very much. We don't need a lesson in how amazingly trustworthy you are. It's been a tough night for the Conservative Party after the loss of some key councils in London to Labour. But the opposition...
Not just in London.
All right.
Somerset has gone from Tory to Lib Dem completely.
Is that a county council?
It is now. Yeah. It's a new unitary county council. So basically...
Based in Taunton.
And with 110 councillors. And basically, there were district councillors that the Liberal Democrats had some input into, but now it's become one large combined authority, and the Liberal Democrats seem to have done extremely well.
And the Conservatives lost Wandsworth, Margaret Thatcher's favourite council, Westminster and Barnet to Labour Party. So there's been some big changes in London. If these results are reflected in a general election, Martin, Boris Johnson will lose his Commons majority.
Yeah, well, obviously we've got some more counts to come tomorrow. I think it's pretty much in line. I mean, the Tories, I think, will be breathing a sigh of relief that it hasn't been worse. Yeah. Because it could have been a lot worse. If the war in the Ukraine hadn't happened, it probably would be a great deal worse. But they've got something else to keep people's attention.
Is this like the Belgrano, the Falklands? Rescued the Conservative Party from an otherwise nightmarish situation of mismanagement of the whole country.
Yeah, well, I mean, there has been a definite bounce in opinion polls for the government as a result of the crisis. incidentally, to be mirrored in Russia, where Putin's approval ratings are 63 to 83%.
This is very worrying if on all sides war is good for the politicians in charge.
Well, that is an issue, because it's very similar to World War One rather than World War Two.
I would suggest it means the media is not doing its job properly.
Coming back to our local elections, I think the thing I'm picking up here is that the Liberal Democrats are eating into the core Tory vote.
Yes.
I mean, you know, you're not going to, you know, because of the alliance that you made with the Tories years ago, the Labour switchers are going to be very iffy about switching to the Lib Dems. But Tory voters think they can vote Lib Dem, and they can hold their noses, vote Lib Dem. And you are taking over the role of what used to be the more moderate Conservative Party, if you like. I'll put it to you that that's where you're going.
Yeah, I mean, in actual fact, where these elections are taking place is not in mainly the most vulnerable areas for the Conservatives, where they are going to lose lots of seats on present form to the Liberal Democrats. It was interesting that a year or two ago we had a defector from the Tory party come to the Liberal Democrats, and the sole reason, he'd been perfectly happy with the Tories for years as a local councillor, and then Boris got elected leader and he said, that's it. Can't touch him with a barge pole, and he jumped ship.
Well, one of the problems with that is if they get rid of him, and no doubt the Tories MPs are thinking about, if they get rid of Boris and get somebody else, then maybe people like that could be brought back on board. But I think there's also a change of mood going on. If you look at the two constituencies, the Lib Dem, by-elections, the Lib Dem, when one was in what you might call Remainer suburbia, yeah, and that would be in line with what you'd expect. But the other one in North Shropshire was hard-line, pro-Brexit, rural Tory seat, and they just were smashed.
The result there actually surprised me. I expected the first one, I expected us to win that, although a lot of people in the media seemed surprised. But the second one was very surprising, and I think actually the local circumstance with the...
Yeah, well, he was, you know, the local guy was in fact in the firing line, wasn't he?
Yeah.
In every possible way, yeah.
But anyway, just looking at the state of the parties since yesterday in England, so the Conservatives have lost about 280 seats around the country. The Lib Dems have done most of the sweeping up there. Three quarters of those, or about 160, have been taken by the Lib Dems, and the Greens and the Labour Party about 50 seats each. So the Lib Dems have been the major winners here, really. And it's almost as if the Conservatives are sinking. And it's always a question, Gary, of who can grab those seats as people get disillusioned with the Tories. And it seems to have been your party.
Well, the thing is...
hang on. Are you actually a Lib Dem these days, or are you an independent?
Well, I'm an independent as far as the council goes. We run our own group on Bristol City Council. With regard to who's going to pick up those seats in the south of England, outside London, it is likely to be, because there's dissatisfaction with the Conservative Party, but the public generally, apart from in London, have not really bought the Labour Party. They've sold the Conservatives, but they haven't bought Labour generally. So in a lot of these areas in the south of England, the Lib Dems will pick up, and particularly in the pro-Remain areas, because, you know, I don't know if you've watched the ongoing polls, but there's an increasing number of people saying not only we shouldn't have left, but we should apply to rejoin. I think that's fraught with danger, but, you know, an awful lot of people are realising what Boris has actually done and how much damage he's actually caused by Brexit.
Well, surely it's not Boris's fault, Brexit. People voted for it.
Well, he managed to successfully lie to them about what would actually happen, and people were swayed behind him. And
what about Farage? I think he played a role as well, didn't he?
Well, yeah, but yeah.
Martin, I mean, is this the Remainiacs just saying, oh, you know, still belly aching on whatever it is 8 years later, six years later off about Brexit?
Well, the fact is that it looks like what the Tories are going to do is, in the Queen's speech that's coming up, they're going to say that they're going to get rid of the Northern Ireland Protocol, which will then put us on a collision course with the Irish government and the other 27 members of the EU, a trade war on top of the Ukraine war, on top of everything else. And, of course, that will not do anything for Elsie on her budget.
Did we have local elections in Northern Ireland?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, well, so they're going to count them tomorrow.
Oh, they've already started. And basically, it looks like Sinn Féin will likely be the largest party.
Which is the first time that's happened.
Can we have a little bit of a prediction from you about what's going to happen there? Well,
Sinn Féin will become the largest party. I think that's been clear for quite a while. But that doesn't mean much because, in a sense, they've got less than 30% of the vote. It's distributed amongst the other parties. The DUP will still probably come second, although the Alliance are, you know, which is a moderate centrist party. They've become more important in Northern Irish politics over time.
Just looking at this live, Martin, Sinn Féin has opened a huge lead in Northern Ireland voting. According to Reuters, the Irish Nationalist Party Sinn Féin secured far more first preference votes in elections to Northern Ireland's regional assembly than its rivals, indicating it was likely to win the election. Sinn Féin secured 29% of the vote compared to 21% by the pro-British Democratic Unionist Party. So looking good for Sinn Féin.
Well, yes, I mean, they'll be happy with that. And what will probably happen is that it'll be clear by the analysis of who voted for what. And don't forget, it's a proportional election, so you can be fairly it'll pretty much reflect people's opinions, is that the majority will vote in favour of parties who want to keep the protocol. In defiance of that, the Tory government in England is going to rip up the protocol and basically, you know, say that the whole deal with Brexit is off.
So what's going to happen? Well, what does this mean for the devolved government and Stormont?
Will happen is the DUP, probably because they're so, they're so upset about the protocol, even though they're in a minority, they will probably refuse to allow the Stormont government to happen.
Is this the beginning of the end for Northern Ireland and the beginning of the reunification?
I think the good news there is it's probably going to be done on a step-by-step basis. The existing Good Friday Agreement gives plenty of minority guarantees. You can't just railroad things through. And I think Sinn Féin basically know that they can't just railroad it through. And it'll take quite a while for the more hardline unionists to accept losing a referendum on it. And therefore, we shouldn't worry about that too much in the short run. Sinn Féin has got its goal of a united Ireland. That doesn't change. Nothing changes on that front. But they've also decided that they're going to pursue it in the kind of way they're pursuing it. But I think what the problem is going to be politically is that although a majority in Northern Ireland, including Alliance parties and other parties, want to keep the protocol is actually what they want. A minority in Northern Ireland, the Loyalists, don't want the protocol, but the Tory right wing here in Britain, in England, will rip up the protocol because Boris believes that by re-energising his Leaver base, he can somehow, you know, get himself out of the hole.
It doesn't look as if the Northern Irish population want it.
No, the
does that matter?
No, hang on, Tony. There's an election going on Thursday. We can look at the result and it will show that people who want to keep the protocol will be the majority in the six counties of Northern Ireland.
Well, that's what I said. So what's the point of Boris railing against this?
Well, it may be that if they face reality that the majority in Northern Ireland don't want the protocol ripped up, then they shouldn't do it. But the Tory right wing has got an internal fight amongst itself. Yeah. And don't forget, there's various people circling to want Boris's crown. And for them, they will push for ripping up the protocol as a way of making themselves more right-wing than thou, so that they can then become prime minister or whatever.
But Gary,
so this is actually very dangerous.
There's something a little bit momentous about this, because Sinn Féin has been around for a century, and it's the first time that it's got to the point where potentially they've got a majority in the north of Ireland.
Well, they haven't got a majority.
No, they've won the election by being the biggest party.
Being the largest party. Yeah. But basically, I think one of the lessons here is actually the growth of the Alliance Party. And what they're complaining about at the moment is that the DUP are going to be the second largest party, probably with about 21% of the vote, and they're going to be able to veto everything. And they're saying that there needs to be a re-examination of the way that devolution works in Northern Ireland to allow the people to have more of a cooperative approach to things. And Sinn Féin know that history is on their side.
Well, it's not just that. It's the Catholic way of doing things that's on their side, because that's one of the reasons that there have been more Catholics born than there have been Protestants.
Well,
the demographic, there's a demographic advantage the Catholics have got, isn't
well,
there?
Well, you could say, I mean, that is to some extent.
I could say it. I did say it. Right, I will say it.
I think the danger here is that if the right wing in England, for their own nefarious reasons, do not defer to what the Northern Irish electorate actually want, then we could be on, but that could cause real problems.
Because
you could end up with a trade war with the rest of the EU. Because we could rip up, you're saying Brexit's done. If you rip up the Northern Ireland Protocol, Brexit isn't done. We've got to go back to renegotiate it all.
We're already suffering because we're incapable of carrying things out which Boris promised to actually do with regard to Brexit. Our exporters actually get everything checked. They've got to jump through lots of different hoops to actually export things to the EU. But all the protocols and on all the checks of goods being exported from the EU to us, the government can't enact them. We've got a one-way trade barrier.
Yes. In other words, British business has been
shafted.
And that's before the protocol is ripped up and we go to a trade war with the rest of the EU in the middle of a global crisis, etc., etc.
Well, various punters and ex-ministers over in Northern Ireland are predicting a long, long wait, several months at least, until there's the Stormont convenes.
Yeah, well, I think I take your point about the alliance, Gary, but I think the idea of keeping the DUP in the tent is part of the underlying part of the deal. You've got to have the loyalist community, with all of its foibles, has got to have it. Got to feel that its voice is being listened to, even if they're the minority.
Absolutely. Having said that, you've got to find a role for
the alliance.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, what you could have is a government of national unity, if you like, with everybody in it. But yeah. I think the problem with that is that the DUP have now dug themselves into a corner where, if the protocol isn't got rid of, they are going to, hold their breath until they pop. Loyalist paramilitaries are saying that they're going to start shooting people, etc. And if it does turn to the loyalist paramilitary shooting people, I think some of the people in England who were so keen to have a hard Brexit need to have a hard look at their own ideology.
It just seems to me it's quite simple that Northern Ireland is actually floating off across the Irish Sea, joining up with Southern Ireland.
Well, it is, but the point about the Good Friday Agreement, and if you remember, we did a Good Friday Agreement special years ago on Good Friday,
we did.
Is that it is. It's a very, very carefully put together agreement which gives everybody a bit of what they want and nobody everything of what they want. And it was very, very hard to negotiate. But I think because I'm fairly confident that there will be no return to violence in Northern Ireland because everybody has been there, done it and got the T-shirt. But that means you've got to keep some of the more extreme elements on both sides on board. So there's been a bit of a fuss in Northern Ireland last week because it was leaked that Sinn Féin had been approaching the dissident Republican Saoirse, I can't pronounce it, and saying, well, why don't you join with us to campaign for a referendum and, give up the armed struggle? Now, that's actually perfectly logical for them to do that, but people have been saying that the IRA, that Sinn Féin and the relatives of Lyra McKee that were killed, if you remember, by the real IRA, they said that they weren't happy about the leaking of the letter at this time, because it's obviously related to political shenanigans rather than a genuine attempt to, I think it's perfectly logical that Sinn Féin should appeal to the more dissident Republicans and say, look, come on, call it a day. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Well, we shall see. We certainly shall. I'll leave the final word to you, though, Gary, on the result of the referendum here in Bristol, because I think people, various people, including this programme, have been picking these things apart, and it seems incredible that the mayoral experiment has been proven to be a failure by the people here. What do you think are going to be the biggest ramifications of the decisions made last night?
Hopefully openness. I think that needs to be far more attention paid to communities. I mean, it's one of the reasons why we are independent in Null, because we have such a good model of organisations actually doing things for themselves. I mean, Swimpool is a perfect example. City Council couldn't run it. The mayor wanted to shut it down. Now it's going to be transferred across in an asset transfer, unless he manages to block it. But already business in that swimming pool has doubled because the community are involved in running it for themselves.
Well, hang on a minute, because the mayor is trying to block the asset transfer now?
I didn't say he was, but there's always a danger. He wanted to close that place down, and his only way that he could get out of it, of the criticism he was getting, said, oh, I'll hand it across to the community. But he's put barriers in the way of that. But despite those barriers, the community can run that and will run it at a good, survivable profit.
Because, I mean, I get the impression that quite a lot of the new system, I mean, we've got this is it a one city plan that's come out?
That's not new. It's been running for 20-odd years. He's just rebranded it and made it worse.
Tell us about One City, because this is one of the things that our Mayor Marvin Rees waves the flag for. He says, well, look at this brilliant system. We've now got these little groups of people from business, trade unionists, etc., that are doing what those councillors used to do, only they're doing it a lot better.
Well, in actual fact, all those places, all those arrangements were in place previously. The partnerships with businesses and whatever happened before. The thing was that previously there was also democratic oversight of that. Now there isn't. So basically what happens is organisations come to the mayor begging for something. He says, right, well, you're going to have to behave yourself and do what I actually say and say that I'm wonderful. And basically that's the corruption of the One City. One City was actually started a very long time ago. It's just got worse.
Interesting thing, I think one of the reasons I asked you to come along, Gary, tonight was because actually before the mayor system, the Lib Dems used to run Bristol, didn't they?
Yes, and sometimes in partnership with others as well. And actually, for a long time, Bristol had been a failure as a city in terms of administration. Under ourselves and with others involved, over a number of years, it was starting to make considerable progress. The city was starting to work very well indeed. And unfortunately, the mayor's system got completely in the way of that.
Well, by basically kowtowing, almost like a proxy mayor, working for some wealthy, powerful influences in the city, such as Business West, the business community, people like John Savage, James Dury, the rest of them, and also, of course, the good old merchant venturers. Anyway, that system apparently is going to go in a couple of years. And I just have to thank you very much, Gary, for coming and sharing your knowledge with us today about the results of this. Generally, people I've spoken to where I live here in St Paul's looking a little bit lighter, happier, that we haven't got this dictatorial style US mayor now, even though it's going to take 2 years to get rid of them. So anyway, we'll be keeping a watching brief on everything that's happening over the next couple of years to see how things go before we go back to the good old fashioned committee system where we actually use the councillors that we elect, the 70 councillors that we elect, to make decisions rather than cede it all to, well, the Labour Party in this case, who nominate the mayor.
Well, in actual fact, if you speak to a lot of people in the Labour Party, they were furious about the mayor system. In fact, we had significant members of the Labour Party actually campaigning with us, although not the official Labour Party line was that they supported having the mayor.
Well, I think we'll probably have to exorcise those from the Labour Party now, Martin, won't we?
Well, no, the official Labour position, I mean, obviously the party has to take a position, so they did. I think what the problem is going to be going forward is you're going to get back to party politics in Bristol. So it'll be a question of which parties get the most votes.
Well,
it's first past the post votes as well. There won't be any proportional.
Before we close, I'd love to get Gary's take on this as well, because the Conservatives campaigned to have the mayor, didn't they? It was their system, and yet when they realised that the wind was changing, they changed their minds and they've decided that they're putting their weight. Well, it's not quite as much weight as other parties in the city behind getting rid of the mayor. What on earth was that about? Were they actually, do you think, really, did they not want a mayor?
Well, I mean, originally they made a serious misjudgment, and they've partially admitted they made a misjudgment. But also on top of that, we've had the Metro mayor system since, which is another excuse for them saying they changed their mind. And that was the reason why George Ferguson in particular changed his mind about the situation. And fair enough, admitting you've got it wrong is one of the best things that politicians can actually do.
Is there anything you've ever got wrong, Gary?
Oh, I'm sure there is, yeah.
Can you think of anything?
Oh, not off
Come on,
no.
Admit it to us. What about selling off the parks? Do you remember that?
We didn't do that.
You won't admit it. Okay.
No, it wasn't a matter of not admitting it. When I was actually running the parks, we acquired more parkland than we've ever done before or since. And we invested
but
in
it wasn't in the right places, was it?
What do you mean not in the right place?
Look, I'm just ribbing you, Gary. But anyway, I mean, you got a. I think it was all these campaigners came out of the woodwork saying, no, you can't have this corner of our park. We like our park. We want our park. We want to keep our green spaces. We want them. We need them.
The policy that we actually pursued was supported by the Parks Forum. And they represent all the parks groups around the city.
So were they selected by you, those people on
the
Parks
No, they're selected
forum?
By the people in the parks around the city. And at the moment, we've got another campaign running on this because some of the money that was actually generated from a couple of sales, there's only two or three went through, the mayor is now saying, and that money was ring-fenced for investment in parks, some of it in local parks, the present mayor is now trying to take that away. So we've got a large petition running to say, honour the agreements made under the Parks and Green Spaces.
Well, I'm just personally just waiting for 3 years' time when the public toilets start to reopen again in the city.
You might be waiting longer than that.
We shall see. No. By which time the Tories will probably take all the money that comes from Westminster down to local government. Anyway, Gary Hopkins, independent, ex-Lib Dem councillor, and actually you were leader of the Lib Dems, weren't you,
yes,
for quite a while
years,
too.
Yep.
Thanks ever so much for joining us.
Leader of the group, not of the party.
Yeah. Well, no. Thank
different
God.
Thing.
Very different. So we're going to close part one by having listened to a lady called Karen Evans, and it's part of a theme we've been doing over the last couple of months, which is to do with end-of-life fraud. So this is people being classed as having dementia when they don't in order to take their houses off them and even to get wills rewritten and this sort of thing. And here is Karen Evans, and I'll put the longer version up of this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk tonight, talking about what she believes is probate fraud that's been going on with when her father died.
My dad was taken into hospital in April 2007 with a stroke. He was taken into hospital, Clatterbridge Hospital, for rehabilitation. And during this time, he wrote a will. And my sister, who went to visit him every day, went to see him one day. And he said, I've just written a will. And he seemed fine about it. He seemed in good spirits. So he was happy with it. Then he was moved to another hospital called Arrow Park Hospital, where soon after he arrived, he was put on the Liverpool care pathway. And there he died, age 74. The Liverpool care pathway is where they withhold all food and drink. My sisters were told not to give him any food and drink, even though he was desperately wanting a drink. And in fact, he even said to my sister at the time, they're trying to kill me in here. And she didn't take him seriously. She, you know, you wouldn't believe that's what happens when you go into hospital. So soon after he died, I got an invoice from the solicitor, and he was on his invoice. He was charging for making a will. This will that my sister had seen him afterwards and that he was really happy about. And then we found out that another will was made after this will. So I contacted the solicitor and I said, was there another will? And he replied that he had realised that he had apportioned the tax wrongly, and he changed the will for our benefit. And this was done in the second hospital. Well, this was confusing for us because he'd invoiced for being there at the will in the first hospital. But eventually, but many, many years later, I actually found that hospital records, when we finally got them, showed that what he'd said wasn't true, that where he's claiming the second will was made, our father wasn't there on that date and time. And in any case, 2 days after he arrived after that in the hospital, the record said he was in end-stage heart failure. So we questioned throughout the 4 years. They dragged the estate matters out for 4 years. Further on, we got the police involved. And when they interviewed one of the remaining witnesses of the will that we were given, or the document which purported to be our father's will, they interviewed the surviving witness and asked him who was present at the signing of the will. And he said it was him, my father and my half-brother. He did not name the other man as a witness as being present. So that in itself invalidates the will. The solicitor had been my father's solicitor for 40 years. And the reason, part of the reason why we found that the there was another will is that my auntie Peggy contacted me and said the original will. And when she made contact with us, she said that as she was leaving, and the solicitor was leaving, my dad said to her, he's a good man. He's a good man. I can trust him. And so we trusted him because my father trusted him. And he'd worked for him for 40 years. The accountant had worked for my dad for 35 years, and I'd worked for him in the business too for 11 years. So it was confusing to us. We thought we could trust them. We hoped we could trust them, but I quickly felt like a hindrance. I felt like we were in a way that they were working for Robert, but not for us. I would say to anyone, if they're thinking of making a will, to speak to all of the heirs and to let them know what you're leaving. And if there are any differences that you want yourself personally, then you can tell them, you know, if there's any differences that need to be made correct, then you can make them. But to speak about it, I think so many people leave wills and they don't talk about them. And so it is hard to know. If my father had said to me, I want, you know, your executor on the will, then I would have known, but people don't talk. I would also wonder if, I know it can be difficult, but if all heirs are executors, the key piece on this is that we were told throughout that we had no rights. And as beneficiaries, apparently we have no, well, they told us we had no rights. We didn't really have any powers. In Spain, beneficiaries have got the same rights as executors. And I wonder if that's why they hid the will from us in Spain, because we actually would have the right to go to the bank and say, give us the bank statements. So I think the law needs to be changed in that respect. It shouldn't be that heirs, that people, completely people outside of the family, can take control of your property that becomes legally yours, I think, as executors. I believe that's the case. And can say to the people that you want to leave your wealth to that you have no right, and can hide it, can cloak it in such, you know, can just hide everything. It doesn't make sense to me. And so I don't know what I'd have done different, but what I've been shocked is that the whole of the regulatory policing, my experience with the probate court wasn't good. But I don't see anyone that's really moved to pull these people to account. Like, we've got, you know, public servants, public paid people. No one has held these people to account. So I'm 15 years down the road. I'm struggling to know if I could trust another solicitor to take this case without doing it to no win, no fee, because I don't trust the legal system now.
So that's a clip from Karen Evans, a longer version of that, which tells her whole, where she tells her whole story. Be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. Her basic tale there is, well, I mean, you might say 15 years after her father died and this whole probate thing went through, why is she still bothered about it? But, you know, she believes quite clearly that her half brother has had a will made, which actually is not a legal will, because it was made at a certain place where apparently her father was not well enough in any way to make a will. He was undergoing some sort of heart surgery. But I mean, these sorts of questions. I think she's got two main messages here. I think one is, and it's a lesson for the rest of us, is to make sure that you don't hand over your exec, the exec, mate, don't make the executors of your will people that you don't know. And secondly, that you make a, some kind of, what she's suggesting is that you don't rely on the courts. Now, she's, I mean, that's the final point she made there about not relying on the courts. Now, you know, this does strike me as, I mean, do you remember, Martin, this guy, Harold Shipman? Because there's been a lot of talk about him, well, a bit of talk over the pandemic period, saying about, you know, do remember that doctors can kill people. I mean, it was something like 250 patients that he killed by injecting them with dimorphine, including allegedly kids as young as 4 years old, but mostly elderly women. And the only reason he was caught, apparently, was because he then started getting wills changed and started making himself the beneficiary of these people's wills. Now, this is obviously fraud, it's theft, but the authorities don't really like to pursue it. They don't like to prosecute it because it's far too difficult. And, of course, fraudsters know that. So I'm sure you can remember, I certainly can, our interviews with Ian Fraser, the financial journalist, and Rowan Bosworth Davis, who were talking about this, you know, message going out from the City of London back in the early noughties, late 1990s, that that fraud was okay. You can get away with fraud, fine, get on with it. We're not going to stop you. And this is just another type of fraud. So I think it's fair to say that since the late mid 1990s, that the regulation of these sorts of things is basically not working anymore. And so fraudsters are taking opportunities to win vast amounts of money from vulnerable elderly people.
Well, but elderly vulnerable people have always been potentially the victims of these kind of frauds, aren't they? And don't forget, she's talking about her half-brother there. He sounds as if he's the main culprit. So it's often people you know who are trying to cheat you out of your legacy or get what they think they deserve.
But the reason she wanted to talk to me was because she has learned so much through this whole process. She doesn't want others to suffer in the same way. So the main thing is make sure that executors of the will are the beneficiaries. So don't try and make it so that there's someone completely independent who you don't really know, because they could be a fraudster and or they could be bribed. I mean, this is something I heard, and I mentioned this a month or so ago. A friend of mine who was a signatory on someone's will, he was threatened that they wanted him to say that it wasn't his signature, and he was offered a rather sizable bribe in order to say it wasn't his signature. So there are people out there who are prepared to do these kinds of simple secret things, but it's very difficult to prove in court after the event that sort of intimidation has gone on. So this is an area where fraudsters are really operating now, folks. Just make sure that you take the advice that we've been handing out over the last few weeks. One is to do video wills with the beneficiaries of your will, and the other one is not to rely on the courts and not to bring in people from the outside to be executors of wills. Make sure it's the people that you want to benefit from it, and the people that you know very well and trust implicitly to do that job. So that's the end of our part one. Thanks very much to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and to former Lib Dem leader and now independent councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. We'll be back after a little bit of music.
Oh, on Bethnal Green, this gay youth you might have seen. Tompkins and I with his girl between. Oh, what a surprise! I praised the Conservatives frank and free. Tompkins got angry so speedily. All in a moment he handed to me two lovely black eyes. Two lovely black eyes. Oh, what a surprise! Only for telling a man he was wrong. Two lovely black eyes. Next time I argued, I thought it best to leave the Conservative side a rest. The merits of Liberals I freely pressed, when, oh, what a surprise. The chap I had met was a Tory true, nothing the Liberals' rights could do. This was my share of that argument too. Two lovely black eyes. Two lovely black eyes. Oh, what a surprise. Only for telling a man he was wrong. Two lovely black eyes. Now this song being nothing if not moral, the moral you've caught I can hardly doubt. Never on politics rave and shout. Leave it to others to fight it out, if you would be wise. Better, far better it is to let Liberals and Tories alone, you bet. And if you're willing and anxious to get two lovely black eyes. Two lovely black eyes. Oh, what a surprise. Only for telling a man he was wrong. Two lovely black eyes. Born again. Two lovely black eyes. Oh, what a surprise. Only for telling a man he was wrong. Two lovely black eyes.
So that's Charles Coburn from 1929, the year of the Wall Street crash. Two lovely black eyes, changing his political views to try and avoid getting those black eyes. And before that, All Are Welcome, which I'm not sure who that was recording it. But another one of those lovely little songs from the BBC's Daily Service, which is on long wave at 9:45 every morning. And it's on some sort of special weird channel on digital, which they've made it particularly awkward to find. But if you're around, I think it's 1 minute before 9:45, you can just about find this channel, which on digital, which appears, and it's called Daily Service Channel. And then, of course, at 10, it disappears completely, and then it flicks you back onto the Radio 4. But they've done a particularly awkward, annoying thing on digital. Of course, they could just put that on Radio 4 Digital or Radio 4 Extra Digital, but they've chosen to make it as awkward as possible to hear the Daily Service. And they have an absolutely revolting kind of crash as well when the Daily Service goes on digital and separates out from Radio 4, just talking over whoever it is that's introducing the other programs. And also, they don't really talk about it much on Radio 4. Occasionally they'll say it's time for the Daily Service, but most of the time we wouldn't even know it's on. So back to part two. Welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show, for those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. And I think the main news this week, Martin, has been from Ukraine, has been about, well, the basic stuff, isn't it? About what's been going on at the Azovstal steel plant.
Well, obviously what's going on is you're not necessarily hearing what's most, you know, there's a lot of news management going on, let's put it that way. The Azovstal steel plant has been in the Western media, and of course it's also been in the media in Russia and elsewhere. But there's all sorts of other things going on. You know, that's just one thing.
Well,
that's
let's
happening.
Just focus on that for a minute. That's why I'm asking you about it. Because we've been getting, I think it was about 3 weeks ago that the plant was finally surrounded and surrendered. And
they haven't
just
surrendered.
Before. No, all right, sorry. Well, they should have surrendered because they can't really fight anymore. They've got loads of civilians in there with them. It does sound as if these are human shields.
Yeah, I think the what they're doing at the moment is that the Azov battalion people are in there who are, you know, are basically a neo-Nazi paramilitary that's been integrated into the Ukrainian regular forces. They are saying that they will release the civilians for food. Yeah. So they won't release the civilians. So it's all being presented in the West as the UN is trying to broker for the Russians to let the civilians out. And the Russians have been saying all along, we want the civilians out. Come out. But there is obviously battalion people who have been refusing to let them out. And that, of course, complicates the operation from the point of view of the Russian forces. Because you've got civilians in there. You can't just do what you'd like.
I suppose that's on one side. What they did originally was they said to civilians living around near the steel plant, it's okay, there's a marvellous bunker down here, so in order to avoid these Russian shelling, come and join us down here.
That's the story that they're putting out. I think a lot of those people are actually, we know. I mean, let's just try and clear up
some... Well, hang on, it's not just the story they're putting out. This is what some of the people that emerged last week from Azovstal have said.
All right.
That they've been staying down there thinking that this would be a good place to avoid the shelling by the Russians.
Yeah, well, the fighting in Mariupol has been pretty severe because you've got thousands of...
The most severe, isn't it? Because yeah. Mariupol is a large city held by the Ukrainian army right in the middle of the region which the Russians want to push the Ukrainian army out of.
Yes, and of course Mariupol voted overwhelmingly in 2014 to leave the Ukraine, which is why Azov were put in there to make sure that the local population couldn't fulfil that aspiration. And of course all the evidence suggests that the way the Russian army is fighting in Ukraine is very similar to what the Syrian army has been doing in Syria, which is they want civilians to be able to leave. But just like ISIS in Syria, the Azov battalion in Mariupol have been shooting civilians. I mean, there's plenty of evidence from Russian media that civilians were being shot dead when they tried to leave, or to, you know, the Russians were saying, come out, we've got lorries to take people away, trucks to take people away and everything. But when they come out, the Azov battalion was shooting people down. Now, that's not come across at all in Western media. And it's now been presented in Western media, this final battle of the Alamo in the Azovstal. Most of the Azov battalion inside the steel plant are not from Mariupol. They're from West Ukraine. They speak Ukrainian.
Do you think there may be mercenaries in there?
Oh, there is mercenaries in there. As we know, there have been British mercenaries who've been captured by the Russians, who incidentally have confirmed that the Ukrainians were killing civilians. That's what they've said.
So whereabouts are the Russians at militarily now? What are they up to?
Well, it's obviously they play their cards fairly close to their chest. Unlike the Ukrainians, who are being advised by a lot of PR people from the West, they don't make also... I mean, for example, it came out this week, Ukraine admitted that the ghost of Kiev, this supposed ace pilot that shot down loads and loads, was made up by them. And they said it was justified because it helped morale.
Well, the Americans have been saying quite a lot, haven't they? They also said this week that the United States, this is on antiwar.com, US officials have been claiming that the US intelligence helped the Ukrainians sink the Russian flagship, the Moskva. Anonymous US officials claimed in NBC News that US intelligence helped Ukraine to sink the Russian warship, flagship of the Russian Black Sea Fleet. They said the Moskva sank on the 14th of April after Ukraine launched two Neptune anti-ship missiles at the vessel. For their part, the Russians insist the Moskva sank in rough seas. The officials said that Ukraine asked for information about a ship sailing in the Black Sea south of Odessa that the US identified as the Moskva. The US helped confirm the location of the Moskva, and then the Ukrainians fired on the ship. According to the officials, US didn't know in advance that Ukraine was going to fire and said the US wasn't actually involved in the decision-making.
Well, there's all sorts of stories being told about this by the Russians, by the Americans, by the Ukrainians. And that's true of virtually every aspect of the conflict.
Well, this is the Americans fessing up, basically. So, yeah, we told them that was the one to hear.
Yeah, but you can't...
That's the one to go for. Yeah. That's the one to hit.
Okay, and these...
And then they decided... The Americans didn't decide to launch the missiles. The Ukrainians did. And then they hit it and sank it.
Yeah. Well, that's what the Ukrainians are saying, and the Americans, for their own reasons, are saying that they helped the Ukrainians. Now, that's all the Americans can say that. It may or may not be true. They may be trying, you know, don't forget they've got internal political reasons for trying to say that we're helping the Ukrainians as much as we can. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, we told them about how to sink the ship. Now, of course, the Russians could say, okay, is that so? Right, so when we sink one of your ships, that'll be okay then. Legitimate targets. Yeah? You've crossed the red line, NATO. Now, at some point, the Russians may decide that NATO's crossed their red line, but they're not going to say where the red line is, and when NATO crosses it, the Russians are going to hit back hard, and they're not going to give any warning. That's what NATO needs to consider.
There's another bit of news on antiwar.com. The Pentagon's saying that it is not giving Ukraine intelligence in order to target Russian generals. So can we believe the Americans when they say that?
Well, the Ukrainians have been saying that they've killed loads and loads of Russian generals. And, the Ukrainians are playing the game of saying loads of stuff which they know not to be true, A, in order to keep their own morale up, and B, also to bamboozle Western publics that they are winning and therefore they need, you know, that they can win and all the rest of it. Now, what people have got to realise is that the Ukrainians are basically making stuff up. So when they say anything, you've got to take it with a massive pinch of salt. So, you know, they've admitted that they created the whole concept of the ghost of Kiev, this so-called ace fighter pilot who shot down 40 Russian planes. None of it true. Absolute rubbish. And in actual fact, most of the video footage of the ghost of Kiev came from a video game. But this is deliberate disinformation put out by the Ukrainian government, who are working very closely with our own special services. And they believe that this is what they call information warfare. You just make stuff up, and therefore that's part of the war game. Now, what the Russian Ministry of Defence are doing is rather more like the way the British used to operate in World War II, which is they don't say very much at all about what they're doing, but what they do say can be checked. And I think what's happened with the Moskva is interesting, because the Russians are basically playing it down rather than up. If they've got intelligence that NATO was involved in sinking the ship, they're not going to necessarily say so, but they're just going to sink a NATO ship when it suits them, or something else that when it suits them.
Well, we've had one of the anchors on the Russian state media, I think it's Channel 1 Russia over there, saying that they could launch a submarine atomic bomb to obliterate Britain, or a series of them, and there would be nothing that the British can do about it.
Well, I mean, I didn't see what that somebody had said that. I mean, it's obvious to everybody that everybody's got nuclear weapons, and so they could be used. Although Lavrov said last week, there's a possibility that this could turn into a nuclear war, but let's hope not. Let's hope everybody's going to be sensible about this. Which is why it's so, I mean, Liz Truss's speech to the Mansion House was actually incredibly belligerent. So, for example, she said the Ukrainians shouldn't cease fire until they've captured all the territory that they've lost to the Russians since 2014. And, of course, at one stage, the regime in Kiev was negotiating quite seriously with the Russians. And you know what put a stop to that? Boris Johnson turned up and told them not to bother. So the British have actually played a particularly pernicious role in this, encouraging the Ukrainians to fight on. And of course, it's quite possible that they're going to lose everything as a result of that advice.
On Tuesday, Israel National News say the Russian media threatened to wipe out the UK with a 1,600-foot-tall nuclear tsunami. Russian state television host threatens Putin will destroy the UK with a nuclear tsunami that will wipe the country off the map. Russian state TV threatened to destroy the UK. On Sunday, Channel 1 Russia presenter Dmitry Kiselyov, that's D-M-I-T-R-Y, K-I-S-E-L-Y-O-V, used his evening primetime show to boast that Russia's Poseidon underwater nuclear drone could make Britain into a nuclear wasteland by creating a radioactive ocean tidal wave 1,600 feet high, the Times reported. Kiselyov, who's known as Putin's mouthpiece, alleged that the bomb would plunge Britain into the ocean's depths. His warning was in response to his claim the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson was allegedly threatening to nuke Russia unilaterally without NATO. According to the Daily Mail, the drone can carry a warhead of up to 100 megatons, several thousand times higher than the atom bomb dropped on Hiroshima. He decided the weapon as being able to raise a giant wave, a tsunami, up to 1,640 feet high. Now imagine that coming down the Avon Gorge, Martin.
Yes, and of course, in actual fact, if anybody uses nuclear weapons, then it's probably the end of human civilization. And everybody should be considering that before they open their silly mouths, like Liz Truss closing off the possibility of negotiations between Ukraine and Russia in her speech. and the Ukrainian government are being encouraged to take a completely belligerent line, when in actual fact this could be settled, which is why the Russians have been negotiating with the Ukrainians. And of course, the Ukrainians refused to negotiate until the special military operation began. They were not going to talk. They were building up their forces, which are now surrounded, on the territory which actually voted to leave the Ukraine in 2014. So where the main Ukrainian army is, mostly made up of people from West Ukraine who speak Ukrainian rather than Russian, and they are sitting on top of Russian-speaking land where people voted to leave the Ukraine in 2014, and they are occupiers of that land. And they are being encouraged to say that they're going to take it all back, including the Crimea, which was never part of Ukraine historically. Therefore, there's no room for compromise, and the Ukrainians must fight on. But the British aren't necessarily going to join them. Because if the British did join them, there would be a reaction like the one you're talking
about.
Well,
what about this question of whether it could go nuclear? One of the most interesting people to talk to about that is someone who should know about it. It'd be interesting to see what you make of what he has to say, Martin. Was on I think it was the World One last week. His name's Professor Michael Clark, and he's a former boss of RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute, which is one of these think tanks in central London, which is just around the corner from the Foreign Office. Effectively, you know, some of these privately funded organisations have got more clout, it seems, sometimes than the Foreign Office. But let's have a listen to what he had to say now.
There's a wildness in the way it's discussed, in the sense that people are throwing around the idea of nuclear war. I mean, if a nuclear weapon were used, it might well be a tactical nuclear weapon in Ukraine itself. And we're a long way from that happening, I have to say. We shouldn't be alarmist about this. But President Putin has hardly made a speech since 2015 without reminding the world that Russia is a big nuclear power. I mean, Russia holds more nuclear weapons than any other single country in the world, and Putin always talks about it. And so he's bound to keep saying this and using this idea of a nuclear threat in order to deter the West from action. And to a degree, that has worked because the West has been very cautious. But that caution is wearing off as we see what is at stake in this particular war as it develops.
I think the idea that nuclear weapons will be used is, I mean, people like to talk it up, because it, in a way, it sort of dramatises.
Well, I think we want
situation.
To understand it, you know, because this is a problem which hasn't really risen much in the world since the 1960s in the Cuban Missile Crisis. Only it seems now we need to kind of reassess this. I mean, he talks there, for example, about the almost casual use of tactical nuclear weapons on the battlefield.
Yeah, but that means that was this kind of thing that was talked in the 1980s, that we're going to use tactical nuclear weapons, and therefore, because they're tactical, they're not real nuclear weapons, and therefore we can talk about using them. But the Russian position has always been clear on this. Any use of nuclear weapons, tactical or otherwise, will lead to overwhelming retaliatory strikes. They want mutually assured destruction. And don't forget that the Western powers, led by the United States, have ripped up the Strategic International Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, the ABM Treaty, all of the treaties that were signed with the evil dictatorship of the Soviet Union to reduce nuclear weapons have been ripped up by the West in recent history. And the Russians are quite right to say, we're not having you putting short-range missiles in our
face.
But I
mean, it sounds to me as if the Russians are being particularly belligerent here. Behind the host, this Dmitry guy on Channel 1, was a graphic showing Britain being erased from the map of the world.
Well, they're very annoyed with the British. Don't forget, he's a loudmouth on TV, like the sort of people that we get on GB News here or whatever, but the Russian version. Of course, plenty of people in Russia are saying, well, we can nuke them, blah, blah, blah. That's the sort of thing we say as well, that idiots say in this country. The reality is that Britain has been a major force in provoking this crisis. The US has got the fundamental blame, but the British in particular are perceived by the Russians as responsible for this mess.
Well,
and don't forget, British special
Martin,
forces may well be inside the Azov plant, as we were talking about earlier. It could be very senior NATO generals inside there.
Well, this does strike me as potentially one of the reasons that they're so reluctant to surrender to the Russians.
That's right. And, of course, they've made several attempts to remove NATO personnel from the plant. Yes, they have. They've been flying helicopters in and been shot down. And that's because that plant is the headquarters of a NATO command structure, which was going to command the top levels of the Ukrainian army are actually run by, you know, British and US officers, and they were about to carry out a blitzkrieg on the Donbass when the Russians blitzkrieged them first. And that will all come out in the history books. Because provided we don't destroy ourselves in a nuclear war, people will go through the record and it'll be clear how and why this crisis came about.
Russian missile threat last Sunday evening on Channel 1 Russia, the tidal wave, it says, is also a carrier of extremely high doses of radiation. Surging over Britain, it will turn whatever is left of them into radioactive desert, unusable for anything. How do you like this prospect, he said. He also threatened that Russia would attack Britain with the Sarmat-2, Russia's most advanced nuclear missile, which they tested 2 weeks ago. He alleged that one Sarmat-2 could obliterate the UK. Their island, he said, is so small that one Sarmat missile is enough to drown it once and for all, he said. It's capable of destroying an area the size of Texas or England. A single launch, Boris, and there's no England anymore.
Yes, and of course the answer to that would be, from the British side, is if you do that, then our Trident submarines will nuke Moscow. And of course, if we'd got rid of nuclear weapons, which I would certainly advocate we should, the Americans supposedly would nuke Moscow. So everybody knows that you could do that, but you don't, because otherwise you're going to get retaliation. The real problem is that the ABM treaty, which stopped both sides building up short-range missiles which could shoot incoming missiles and therefore give the hope of a first strike, that's been ripped up. And they're now moving short-range missiles, the problem with short-range missiles is the time factor. These short-range missiles that are now going to be put in Poland, Romania, and possibly in the Ukraine if the Russians hadn't acted, would be able to hit Moscow in about 5 minutes. So you've only got 5 minutes to decide whether you're under attack or not. And therefore, you've got to have everything on a hair trigger, which is precisely why we had all these agreements to build down nuclear threat. If the main nuclear weapons are ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles held in Russia and the US, then that way that we can avoid nuclear war quite easily, because everybody will be able to see those coming from a mile.
Well, another thing the Russians are saying is that NATO is not taking the nuclear war threat seriously enough. The Russians' envoy to the US told Newsweek, leaders of the US-led NATO military alliance do not grasp the true gravity of a potential nuclear conflict erupting as a tense war of words amongst powers looms over the ongoing fighting in Ukraine. As officials and other influential figures of the US and allied nations accuse the Kremlin of summoning the spectre of nuclear war over NATO's support for Ukraine against Russia's devastating invasion, Moscow's ambassador in Washington, Anatoly Antonov, disparaged what he called a flurry of blatant misrepresentations of Russian official statements on our country's nuclear policy. In fact, he said, it was those in the Western Bloc that have proven irresponsible in their handling of what's been described as one of the most dangerous moments since the Cuban Missile Crisis 6 decades ago. The current generation of NATO politicians clearly does not take the nuclear threat seriously, Antonov's told Newsweek. So I guess what he's really saying here is that they are poking the bear. They're provoking Russia. Well, actually, surely it's the other way around. The Russians are provoking the Ukrainians, and they're provoking NATO by going into Ukraine.
No, don't forget,
NATO is not in Ukraine, Martin. Russia is.
When we started talking about nuclear weapons, I'll just reiterate that the Western powers, the Americans, supported by the British, have ripped up all of the treaties that were signed with the USSR on nuclear weapons. And the Russians have responded by saying, well, if you're going to do that, we are going to modernise our nuclear forces and we're going to put them in a position where we cannot be first striked. They're in that position now. Their hypersonic missiles, which can have conventional warheads as well, are now capable of hitting anywhere on the planet. And they can't be stopped. There isn't any possibility of shooting them down. And the West simply doesn't have that kind of missile technology. Now, that doesn't mean that the Russians are going to carry out a first strike. It just means that the West can't carry out a first strike. And if it tried to do it, it's going to be incinerated. Now, the whole crisis in Ukraine began in 2014 with a coup orchestrated by the Western intelligence services involving the massacre of demonstrators by a NATO death squad. And then, of course, the Donbass voted to leave Ukraine, just as people in Yugoslavia voted to leave, Slovenia voted to leave Yugoslavia, Croatia voted to leave, Bosnia voted to leave.
This is just detail. The fact is, fingers could be near the buttons.
They are near the buttons. They're very near the buttons. And the danger is, just as in the run-up to... People talk about World War II, and the real danger was that we should have stood up to Hitler sooner, and everybody just hung, you know, wasted time, and the only way to stop aggression is to nip it in the bud. But they're forgetting the history of World War I, where everybody makes what they think are rational decisions, and that the collective outcome is disaster. And that is definitely a problem.
Okay,
here.
Well, it's I think a very interesting, enlightening interview with the Russian. He's the ambassador to the US. And Antonov, he says, while US officials cast Russia as the aggressor in escalating nuclear tensions, because we don't actually see much of this, do we? Very interesting to hear the Russian point of view, what with RT blocked, etc. Blocked off my computer here, by the way, as well. I can only watch it on my phone, read it on my phone at the moment. Antonov called these accusations baseless, that the Russians were escalating the tensions and part of a propaganda campaign launched against Russia in response to the steps taken to neutralise threats to our national security emanating from Ukraine. He then outlined the conditions under which the use of nuclear weapons is possible, as per Russia's official doctrine, which he says states that such weapons of mass destruction can be used in response to the use of weapons of mass destruction against Russia and its allies, or in the event of aggression against our country when the existence of the state is jeopardised. But Antonov believes his Western colleagues misread the weight of the nuclear risk, and that's why Russian officials have never stopped in our efforts to reach agreements that will guarantee such a catastrophic confrontation will not be unleashed. And you're quite right, Martin. It's actually NATO and the United States that's ripped those agreements up that were put together in the Reagan era.
That's right. And people think that it doesn't matter, but of course it does matter. Those agreements were there for a reason, to protect the human species from extinction. And the West arrogantly has ripped those up. Gorbachev, who is still alive and signed those agreements, is in support of the Russian government's position on all of this, with a very heavy heart, because he says they're being very, very arrogant. And they are. And in actual fact, they have provoked the war in the Ukraine over the last 8 years. It didn't start 3 months ago. It started 8 years ago. And it's been going on for 8 years. 14,000 people in the Donbass have been killed, mostly Russian-speaking civilians. And, of course, they don't count for anything in the Western calculation.
And Joe Biden, the US president, has announced this week, he started with $3 billion aid, and now it's gone up to $33 billion. That's an interesting number, to go to Ukraine to help give them freedom from the dictator Putin. So let's have a listen to what he said when he was at the Lockheed Martin plant,
The Javelin missiles
are made this week. Joe Biden announcing his £33 billion funding for the Ukrainian army for mercenaries and private military companies and weapons.
We made sure that there are no interruptions in the flow of equipment to Ukraine. Since Russia invaded Ukraine just over 2 months ago, we have sent more than $3 billion in security assistance to Ukraine alone, us, not counting our allies. And that money is a direct investment in defending freedom and democracy itself. Because if you don't stand up to dictators, history has shown us they keep coming. They keep coming. Their appetite for power continues to grow. And every worker in this facility and every American taxpayer is directly contributing to the case for freedom. And that's something we can all be incredibly proud of, in my view. Last week, I sent Congress, if you excuse the point of personal privilege, talking like an old senator, but sent a supplemental budget, a fancy way of saying we need more money, to make sure the United States can continue to send weapons directly to the front lines of freedom in Ukraine, and to continue to provide economic and humanitarian assistance to help the Ukrainian people. And I urge the Congress to pass this funding quickly to help Ukraine continue to succeed against Russian aggression, just as they did when they won the Battle of Kyiv. And to make sure the United States and our allies can replenish our own stocks of weapons to replace what we've sent to Ukraine. As I said from the beginning, this fight is not going to be cheap. But caving to aggression would even be more costly.
But he doesn't actually mention the figure, but it is indeed $33 billion he wants from Congress in order to send to the Ukrainian army. Now, of course, that isn't just money for them. It's weapons, it's mercenaries, it's all sorts of other aid in order to keep this war going.
Well, not least, it's money in the pockets of the people who work in the Raytheon plant where they produce the Javelin missiles, which is presumably why he made the speech there. So he's trying to sell it to the American people as we're spending $33 billion here, but hey, this is all about your jobs.
Actually, funnily enough, that's exactly what he goes on to talk about next, jobs.
We either back the Ukrainian people as they defend their country, or we stand by as Russia continues its atrocities and aggression. I know what the answer is, and I think you all do too. I bet I know what the answer to this plan is. There's something else here that to be understood. Being the arsenal of democracy also means good-paying jobs for American workers. In Alabama and the states all across America where defense equipment is manufactured and assembled, 265 people here at this plant are directly employed working on the Javelin program. All told, Lockheed Martin has brought nearly 3,000 jobs to Alabama. The armed forces of the United States of America will continue to be the best armed, most capable fighting force in the history of the world. In order to do that, we have to make sure our vital defense supplies are getting the inputs and supplies they need to produce and protect and provide the full capacity.
I've just got two words to answer that, which is budget deficit. So this is what this a lot of this is about. The $33 billion will be spent inside the US in plants like that. So the Raytheon, the shareholders of Raytheon will make money, who are the main funders of the political parties in the US. That's where their money comes from. And of course, what will happen with all this kit is a lot of it's going to be destroyed by the Russians because it can't be brought into the country.
So it won't make its way to the front line. As it comes across the border, there'll be boom.
They're already whacking stuff as it comes over the border. The other thing that's going to happen to anything that does get through is it's going to be sold on into the black market, because this is Ukraine we're talking about here, where everything is run by oligarchs who just look after number one. So a lot of this, the small arms are going to end up in the hands of criminal groups and terrorist groups around the world. That's what's going to happen to that.
Finally, Joe Biden. Well, there's quite a lot more to this talk, but this was just a little live thing that they carried on the BBC news channel. US President Joe Biden talks about the semiconductors and the way that when I heard him talk about semiconductors, I was thinking, hang on a minute, isn't one of the major ingredients of semiconductors something that you can only get from Russia? So how are they going to build these semiconductors if they're going to have sanctions on Russia? But anyway, let's have a listen to Biden's little thing about microchips now.
I learned on the tour today that each of the Javelins you produce includes more than 200 semiconductors. I've been a broken record, as the press will tell you, on our need to be able to produce more semiconductors in the United States. We invented the sucker, going to the moon. We, the United States, we're the one that modernized it. We've done more than anybody else. But guess what? We stopped investing in ourselves. And so now we're back in the game, making sure that we become the primary producer of those semiconductors. Computer chips that power much of our modern lives, on our phones, our cars, almost anything that has an on-off switch. And the semiconductor is critical to defense production capacity, as you all know better than I do. That's why we're making it as hard as we can for Russia to get hold of these semiconductors and advanced technologies that it could use to upgrade its military during this conflict. And why we're taking steps to make it easier to source what we need here in the United States during a global semiconductor shortage. And there's just one more reason why Congress has to act quickly to provide the emergency funding of the so-called CHIPS Act by passing a broader bipartisan innovation act so we can produce tens of millions of these chips.
Well, the production filière for semiconductors is globalized, because the world economy is globalized. So a lot of the raw materials, for example, are not available inside the United States. So we could move towards a world in which there will be, you know, two blocks where there will be internal trade within those blocks, but no trade between the two blocks. We're a long way away from that.
I'm reminded of the Second World War, where the access to oil supplies after Al-Alamein and Montgomery's victory over Rommel proved quite crucial because oil was the main thing that was needed. Now, in a modern war, it's not necessarily going to be oil which wins the war. It could be something as simple as microchips, as semiconductors, especially in electronic warfare, cyber warfare, all this sort of thing. The ability to build these things might be crucial.
Well, of course it is. It's obviously crucial, but don't forget that basic stuff...
You've got to have access to the raw materials,
well,
haven't you?
Yes, you've got to have access. And don't forget that having enough fuel for your tank or whatever it is still still vital as well.
I think you might be right. Well, it's interesting with sanctions that this week European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has announced proposals on Thursday that would see EU member states banned from buying any Russian crude oil within 6 months. Now, this hasn't gone down well in Czechoslovakia or Hungary at all. In fact... Viktor Orban has made it absolutely clear that he's going to veto this. Now, in a way, the European Commission knows that the Hungarians are not going to put up with this, but they're bringing it, they're going to do everything they possibly can to force it through anyway. So what's going on here? Why is von der Leyen saying no Russian oil when clearly there are countries in Eastern Europe that are not happy about that at all? They're simply not going to do it. They're not going to agree to it. They're going to veto it. What's she playing at?
Well, I mean, there's an awful lot of virtue signalling. So we're all supposed to be on the same page, Putin dictator, aggression, blah, blah, blah. And therefore, one of the things, and the Ukrainians, of course, are saying that we've got to stop taking Russian gas and oil immediately. Incidentally, of course, the Ukraine is still being supplied with Russian gas through their pipelines, and they haven't paid the bills for years, but the Russians basically keep them on the main line of gas because the gas is then sold on to countries further west, but also because they've got no interest in trashing ordinary people in the Ukraine.
So this time last week, Bloomberg reported today, Bloomberg reported the European Union had proposed revising this ban on Russian oil to give Hungary and Slovakia, which is also greatly reliant on Russian energy, until the end of 2024 to comply with the sanctions. But even with these exemptions for the two countries, the EU is already facing pushback today from Hungary and Slovakia, who could veto even that sanctions plan, giving them until the end of 2024 in 2.5 years' time to comply with these Russian oil sanctions.
Well, it's an interesting question, isn't it? How does the EU actually work? Can countries veto everybody? And it's not just saying we're not going to do it. Hungary's got a veto and can say, well, the EU as a whole can't do it. And don't forget, even if they make exceptions for countries which are dependent on Russian oil and gas to carry on trading, that basically means that they will be sucking up resources which would, you know, other countries who are getting rid of Russian oil and gas will lose out to those that carry on being supplied. And that's a recipe for squabbles. If we are, as a united West, going to get rid of gas and oil from Russia, then countries like Britain, which aren't very dependent on gas and oil from Russia, guess what? You've got to raise taxes on your wealthy people to transfer resources to the frontline states so that they can then not have to rely on Russian oil and gas. But if you want them to do that, you've got to pay them to do that. The United States of America is actually increasing its imports of diesel from Russia at the same time as insisting that Western Europe and Eastern Europe stop importing oil and gas from Russia.
Oil is
extraordinary.
A major part of this, isn't it? And it was quite interesting that the guy who is behind Vladimir Zelensky, he owned the TV station that Zelensky became famous on as a comedy president and then took on the role in reality, Ihor Kolomoisky. He is an interesting guy because he was involved in the privatized version of the old Soviet oil company in Ukraine, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, he was one of these oligarchs that got their hands on assets during the era of privatisation, which was rammed down the throats of people in Eastern Europe by Western advisors.
Well, we use the word oligarchy quite a lot on here, the idea that it's basically a few rich people that control everything and that democracy is a bit of a sideshow. But here in Ukraine, it's been quite clear that's what's been going on. And these guys are, and you know, you can often get accused of anti-Semitism for saying this, but it's an absolute clear fact, as it was with the 9/11 attacks and many of the people involved in covering those up in the US. In that case, it was dual US-Israeli citizens. In this case, these oligarchs, almost all of them, are dual Ukrainian Israeli citizens.
That is true. And don't forget, if you're a criminal oligarch, having a hidey hole in Israel when things get a bit too hot where you actually come from is one of the things you do. And Anatoly Chubais, who was one of the architects of the Gaidar reforms in Russia in the 1990s, which impoverished the vast majority of the population and enriched the oligarchy, he has now moved from Russia to Israel. As a way, you know, because basically he's becoming the elements within the Russian political elite, which were pro-Western, are now finding their situation becoming untenable within Russia. Well, anyway, and many of them are actually going to Israel.
I came across what I thought was a fascinating news report from Euronews about Kolomoyskyi, because he was one of the, he was a governor of a province which borders on the Donbass. So in other words, he was very much involved in the war going on down there, effectively, and he wanted to kind of claim that territory for his, you know, his units that he was involved in. He's also a Thunder Martin, isn't he? Is he not of the Azov Battalion?
Yes,
you know,
he
the Nazis.
Yes, he's Jewish, and he's got Israeli citizen, dual Israeli Ukrainian citizenship. But he's also funded the Azov Battalion, which are basically Nazi paramilitaries, and he's also used them in his personal disputes. You know, it's basically like a private army. And he also arranged for the neo-Nazi elements within the Ukraine to be supplied with weaponry by the Israeli Defense Forces. And, of course, they've all been trained, these Azov units, by the Israelis, by the British, and by the Americans. So we've directly armed and trained these paramilitaries.
Well, I think we've got to expose this guy, Ihor Kolomoyskyi, and also Viktor Pinchuk, who we heard last week being accused of being in charge of the main Masonic lodge in Ukraine, which was cooperating with the CIA and running the Maidan coup. So there's a, I thought, absolutely brilliant piece of journalism from Politico journalist in the United States. His article is entitled Ihor Kolomoyskyi, the Ukrainian oligarch behind Zelensky's rise to fame, brought a Midwestern factory as part of the world's largest ever money laundering scheme and let it rot. So I'll put a link up to this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It's what he's saying in Politico, Martin, and this is an article which was published, I'm just looking for when it was published in 2021, before all this Ukraine invasion happened by the Russians, or the special military operation, whatever you want to call it. The article was written by Casey Michael, CASEY MICHEL. So the US prosecutors are saying the decaying plant was part of a broader scheme to launder millions in stolen dollars across the American Midwest. And it's an absolutely fascinating article. I just read the whole thing from start to finish. It's a bit like The Guardian's long read, but it's all about how this plant and a whole load of Israeli citizens, as well as working basically for Kolomoyskyi, were using these massive, it was redundant, basically. It was built, but it was never actually used to manufacture stuff, because I think it was Motorola that originally built it, realized that they could manufacture stuff cheaper abroad, so they never used the plant. But this was then bought by Kolomoyskyi as part of what he calls in the article the biggest money laundering scheme in the world ever.
Yes, I mean, these are the people who've been in charge in the Ukraine since the 1990s. And Ukraine is still in the same condition that Russia was in the 1990s. The Russian policy has changed fairly dramatically since then. But the Ukraine has continued to be dogged by being run essentially by mafia capitalists.
But is there something bizarre going on here? Because Kolomoyskyi is actually wanted in the US for this money laundering scheme. And yet there they are supporting him still. But Biden is supporting him. So they're bashing him with one hand and they're propping him up with the other.
Yeah, but the people who are wanting prosecuted will no doubt be low level officials of the...
Well, it's the Department of Justice.
That's right. So, in other words, they're not directly political in one sense. They're following up leads that they've got and all the rest of it. You know, the ruling elite in the Ukraine are utterly reprehensible people. But we're being Zelensky is a front person for that ruling elite. Incidentally,
well, hang on. Kolomoyskyi is sanctioned by the United States, but the State Department says for significant corruption and ongoing efforts to undermine Ukraine's democratic process.
Yes, well, in actual fact, what's happened, at one stage, they were the Western powers were trying to say that you've got to clean up your act in Ukraine, otherwise we're not going to give you any more money. And then, of course, now, because of the war and all the rest of it, they're saying, well, we'll have to backpedal on that because obviously, we want you to win the war. And the hypocrisy involved is enormous. I mean, Hunter Biden's laptop shows that the Biden family directly involved in the looting of Ukrainian national assets, and also, incidentally, involved in the funding through Burisma Holdings, I think it is, of the biolabs, which people have just lost track of altogether.
Vox magazine talks about the Kolomoisky's private militia that he's got. He's basically built his own private army over in Ukraine. Vox magazine, back in 2015, says pro-Kiev militias are fighting Putin, but has Ukraine created a monster that it cannot control? And there's the Azov battalion with their balaclavas and their salutes and their Nazi symbols. The Eastern Ukrainian conflict is typically seen as a war between the Ukrainian military and the Russian-backed rebels, fighting alongside unacknowledged Russian forces on the other. But there is another faction fighting as well that has gone largely overlooked, the dozens of private volunteer militias that share Ukraine's goal of crushing the separatists, but that aren't necessarily operating under its control. These groups have proved useful to the Ukrainian government's war effort, but they pose a serious threat to the long-term stability of Ukraine. By many estimates, there are approximately 30 of these private armies fighting on the Ukrainian side. Their fighters are accused of serious human rights violations, including kidnappings, torture, and extrajudicial executions.
Yes, well, I mean, what's happened in the Ukraine in recent weeks is that all opposition parties have been banned, including the main opposition party to Zelensky's party, Medvedchuk, who is another Ukrainian oligarch, but of, you know, slightly more pro-Russian orientation. He's been shown pictures of him. He's obviously been beaten up. He's an old guy. And there's talk of him being, he's a politician, an elected politician. He's been put under house arrest and beaten up by the SBU, which is the Ukrainian Gestapo, if we can call it that. And there's been discussions going on that he should be exchanged with the Russians for the British guys that have been captured in Mariupol. Now, think for a moment what that means. So the Azov people inside the plant are bargaining for food, and then they will release civilians. So they're basically hostage takers. And they're also saying that British military personnel, not directly British military, but mercenary personnel who've been fighting, can be swapped for the leader of the opposition in Ukraine. And if you look at Amnesty International reports about Ukraine, loads of people have been disappeared. There's routine use of torture. In fact, journalists have been murdered. But this is a democracy,
well, I would have
which
to
we
say,
are supposedly defending.
I'm going to have to say to Amanda Taub, writing in Vox magazine, yes, Ukraine has created a monster it can't control because Kolomoisky has got too big for his boots, and especially with these private militias and funding these neo-Nazis. Now, this is something which came up this week, Martin, isn't it? The questions about the Ukrainian president Volodymyr Zelensky being Jewish, how could he possibly be supporting a Nazi faction within his own country and Nazi militias, etc.? And Sergei Lavrov brought this up this week, didn't he, to much consternation, saying, well, actually, Adolf Hitler may have been part Jewish, and that's what we think at the Russian Foreign Ministry. So it doesn't mean to say that just because you're a racist and a Nazi that you can't be a Jew as well. Be part Jewish.
Well, I mean, the point is that in actual fact, as you know, Tony, the Zionist movement cooperated with the Nazis in the 1930s. This is the reason why Ken Livingstone was booted out of the Labour Party. He just happened to point that out. And, of course, the right wing in Israel, the Yabotinskyites, modelled their movement on Mussolini's black shirts. And I don't see that you can say that Nazism, fascism, all of this stuff is a disease of human civilization, and Jews are as likely to be infected with it as anybody else. Don't forget, loads and loads of other people other than Jews were also liquidated by the Nazis.
Does
anybody claim that they can't be racist?
Well, the amazing thing here is that the guy that's been funding these Nazi battalions, units, a part of the Ukrainian army now in Ukraine, is himself Jewish, Kolomoisky. So let's have a listen now to this Euronews report on Kolomoyskyi and what happened when the central government in Kiev started to investigate his privatized oil company.
Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko has accepted the resignation of Ihor Kolomoyskyi, the oligarch governor of Dnipropetrovsk, a key region in the east of the country. Forbes magazine estimates Kolomoyskyi's fortune at $1.8 billion. Kolomoyskyi has been embroiled in a political intrigue since a few nights ago when unidentified armed men erected steel caging around the entrance of the building in which oil company Ukrnafta is headquartered in Kiev. This followed on the heels of an amendment last week in Parliament of a law on public-private partnerships. Ukrnafta is majority-owned by the state, 50% plus one share, the largest oil and gas producer in the country, bringing in hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. But the state was having difficulty collecting. Now, however, the Parliament's amendment of the law allows Ukraine to reap dividends, where before this was blocked by 42% owner Kolomoyskyi. Minister of Energy and Coal Volodymyr Demchishin comments on what some have described as the fortification of the company's headquarters. Demchishin tells Euronews, any change in the management of a company like this means someone loses his control. If that someone who is losing control used to make profits and administered huge resources, then of course I understand why these people are fighting. It's to prevent someone else from taking control. Kolomoyskyi controls large parts of Ukraine's economy, including in the energy, banking, media, aviation and metallurgical sectors. The way many in Ukraine see things, his inner circle ran Ukrnafta until the law change put a stop to that. But Kolomoyskyi says that's false. PR experts invented a story about me being angry and some nice members of parliament regaining control of the oil company, fulfilling Maidan protesters' wishes. Ukrnafta was always under state control, together with the private shareholders. This is a publicity stunt to boost the stature of political parties who backed the amendments. A company owned by Ukrnafta reinforced security because the company was afraid of a corporate raid. Kolomoyskyi has been a valuable contributor to the national cause, funding volunteers, fighting pro-Russian separatists, and retaining control of parts of the eastern Dnipropetrovsk region.
That is Euronews talking about Kolomoyskyi. I find it fascinating, the idea that he has privatized this oil company. He only owns something like 40% or 49% of the, and the government's still got a golden share. And the government's saying, hang on, guys, you're not paying your tax, even though it's got the majority shareholding. They're not paying their taxes. And so Kolomoyskyi's reaction is to send his militia to barricade the building, turning it into a fortress. So because he doesn't want to pay his tax and he's simply not going to, but this is the way things apparently have been working over there.
Well, that's right. As I said earlier, the Ukraine has been mired in the bezpredel, which means no rules capitalism, which Russia has managed to drag itself out of. In my book, which I wrote in 1998 with Laszlo Andor, who became a Hungarian European Commissioner eventually, we predicted in the book that the Western policy preceded the structural adjustment of the Ukraine, which is basically Western pillaging of its resources and, you know, the creation of oligarchs like Kolomoyskyi, would lead to a civil war in the Donbass. And that book was published in 1998. And it was quite obvious that this was going to end in this kind of conflict, because the Donbass is the industrial heartland of Ukraine, and they need a policy which actually helps industry rather than one that lines the pockets of oligarchs.
Well, Time magazine did a brilliant, I think it was around about 2019, around about the time that Zelensky was elected and Poroshenko was lost the election in Ukraine, about the white supremacist militias. Now, they do, you know, they don't put Nazi in the title, but it's quite clear in this Time magazine documentary. It's only about 10 minutes or so long, but here's a little extract from it, that these people really are Nazis that are operating over there, that are funded by Kolomoyskyi, supported by the central government, by the Ukrainian army, and now, of course, by NATO and the West too.
When it was founded in 2014, Azov drew many of its commanders and recruits from Ukraine's most notorious far-right groups, including including outright neo-Nazis.
We basically recruited everyone who could hold weapons in their hand when Ukrainian state was paralyzed and the defense of Ukrainian state was totally in the hand of Ukrainian volunteers. So there were many war adventurers, guys who believed that they are on a kind of ideological tour to save maybe the future of the West and so on and so forth. So
the future of the white race?
Yes.
Azov's paramilitary wing is now a major fighting force, with its own bases and training grounds near the front lines of the war against pro-Russian forces. After the Veterans Parade in Kyiv, I interviewed Andrei Biletsky, who founded the Azov movement in 2014. Azov's leaders have also tried to break into politics. They failed to win any seats in parliament during the most recent elections in 2019, but their plans in Ukraine are ambitious.
Today, I feel the protest of my nation.
What worries officials in the West is Azov's recruitment strategy. It's tried hard to build friendships with far-right groups around the world, especially in the US and Europe. During my visit in 2019, I spent a day at one of the biggest recruitment events in Azov's history. Thousands of people showed up for a day of fighting sports and blatant propaganda. There were neo-Nazi symbols, tattoos, and posters all over the place. And many in the crowd seemed pretty receptive to Azov's far-right ideology.
Бути толерантним про ЛГБТшникам – це неприродне. Для цього треба людині промити мозки. Поважати своїх батьків, любити своїх дітей і пишатися за свою країну – це нормально.
Events like this also tend to attract recruits from abroad. One of the ones I met was named Robin, who had just arrived in Ukraine from Sweden, where he told me he's wanted for hate crimes.
This is hard to explain the surroundings for someone who's watching this, you know. It's surreal. It's like, I don't know, it's like something you read about the Great Germany before, you know, in the 1920s. It's a revival of the Indo-European soul. Mm-hmm. And it's all happening here in Ukraine.
Afterward, we rode back to the Azov base in northern Kyiv, where Azov commanders had allowed Robin to stay as a potential recruit.
We are Aryans, and we will rise again. That's a way of life, you know. And after the war in Germany, we went back to the benches, school benches. But now we will rise again.
So they're saying that the Aryan races will rise again, Martin. So they went back to the, I think he says, school benches there after World War II, and now they're back.
Well, they are, and they're not, it's not only that this is there's an indigenous far-right ideology in the Ukraine, particularly in the West Ukraine, but these paramilitary formations have been armed and trained by our British taxes. And the reason why they became dominant is because the Ukrainian army is a conscript army, and in 2014, many of them, quite rationally, decided that they didn't want to fight, and therefore they were not actually that much use. So that what the Azov battalions and others provided to the Ukrainian government was, you know, willing cannon fodder. And of course, Zakachenko, who was the elected prime minister of the Donbass, was killed in a car bomb some years ago now. That car bomb was undoubtedly planted by the Ukrainian secret police, the SBU, and I'm pretty confident that people from British special forces assisted them. Now, if you're going to go around killing other people's elected politicians, maybe people like Boris Johnson will have to think about watching their back.
When it comes to the Nazis, one person has been quite good in explaining and describing how they operate, and that is former UN weapons inspector. We've interviewed a couple of times on this show since the invasion in February, and that's Scott Ritter. So this is what he had to say last week about the Ukrainian Nazis from an interview which was calling itself Facts About the Ukraine War.
The greatest threat facing Europe today is NATO. World War II is supposed to end with harmony, but instead it turned into the Cold War. I'd like to finish this war and finish the Cold War. I'd like to find a way for Russia and Europe to peacefully coexist and for America to have a realistic role in European affairs without having to be the dominant power in Europe.
Right. You want to finish Nazism.
Absolutely.
Right. Which is going to require some force.
Hey, you know, no, not some force. It's going to require a lot of, let's just be blunt. a lot of bad people are going to die. You know, and some people get mad at me when I use this analogy, but, you know, maybe I shouldn't, but I will anyways because I'm an honest guy. I love dogs. I own three of them. I go to the dog park, and nothing brings more joy to my heart watching all those dogs run around. And I will bend over backwards for a dog, you know, as most dog lovers will. Mm-hmm. But if you got a rabid dog running through the streets, I will gun him down. I will hunt him down. I will kill him without mercy because he's not a dog anymore. He's a diseased animal. I love humans. I want to peacefully coexist with humans. But Nazi ideology is a diseased ideology, and a human that has absorbed it is a diseased human. And they should be treated like rabid dogs.
Well, I mean, I tend to agree with the sentiment, but I think if the Russian military are wise, and I think their leadership is wise, you want people to surrender. And therefore, you don't.
Well, I mean, Azovstal, we started there. They've just refused to surrender. They're saying, we don't trust the Russians. We've seen all these atrocities, etc. So we were refusing to surrender to the Russians. We think they're going to kneecap us, kill us, whatever, execute us. And so we will only surrender if we're allowed to go back to Ukrainian cities. And, of course, the Russians don't really want to do that. They much rather process them. And some would say, certainly from the Ukrainian side, that they'd be at the Russian mercy.
Well, they would be, just as Russian POWs at the Ukrainians' mercy. And we saw what happened in the videos when they fell into the hands of Azov-style paramilitaries, who basically tortured and killed Russian prisoners of war.
Well, they were shooting them in the legs. That's what we saw. Yeah. Although that hasn't really been broadcast in the mass media here. That clearly was what the Ukrainian soldiers were doing. I mean, whether they're Azov or not isn't clear. But these, you could actually see them shooting them in the legs as they were getting out of the transit van. So this is what amazes me is that is quite clearly a war crime, but they're quite happy to film it and then broadcast it around the world.
Well, the reason why they filmed it is because the elements that were involved in that, they do not want the Ukrainian conscript army to surrender. So the propaganda inside the Ukrainian army is don't surrender to the Russians because they're beasts and they will and they will kill you and they will torture you. And the reason why they broadcast the footage of them doing exactly that to Russian POWs was that they were hoping that the Russians would then start doing that to Ukrainian POWs, which would then encourage them not to surrender. But the evidence I've been seeing, and of course there's a fog of war, who knows exactly what's going on the ground, but if you think of it from a military point of view, what the Russians want is for the Ukrainian regular army to surrender, and therefore they do not want them to be mistreated. They're basically saying, if you surrender, we will feed you and look after you, and when you can go home, we'll let you go home, because that's what we want. We don't actually want to fight with you. And that is actually militarily the best policy, which is why, of course, the Russians as a professional army, just as they've done in Syria, are approaching this in this kind of way. There's no particular reason to kill people if you don't have to kill them. But what's actually happening on the ground now, we were talking earlier about what the military situation is, the Russians are stabilizing where their front lines are, and they're basically pulverizing the Ukrainian army with artillery. And they're dying in large numbers, and many of them want to surrender, but they don't know how. And that is, and don't forget, they've also dug themselves in, like in Mariupol, in civilian areas where there are lots of Russian-speaking civilians who the Russians don't want to kill. It's a bit of a problem. But of course, there's similar problems in Syria with ISIS and Al Qaeda. They don't care about the civilian population, but that doesn't mean that the Russians shouldn't.
Well, last week we heard a long version, and we're going to hear a little short clip of it now, of this Ukrainian general, Yan Kazimirovich, who I found so fascinating as he's detailing all the people who were actually running the coup back in 2014 and their links to this Masonic Lodge and the Central Intelligence Agency in working in Ukraine too. I mean, the allegation, Martin, is that really since that coup, the CIA and our very own wonderful MI6 have been instrumental in the Ukrainian security structure. Is there any evidence for that?
So there's overwhelming evidence for it. What British people have got to understand is, as Liz Truss so eloquently put it in her Mansion House speech, this is our war. British Special Forces, I suggested earlier, could have been involved in the assassination of Zakarchenko, the Prime Minister of the Donbass Rebel Republic. Is that a legitimate military target?
Also providing targeting information for the Ukrainians to sink the Moskva, the flagship of the Black Sea Fleet. But I mean, do you believe the US when they say we are not supplying details of whereabouts the Russian generals are for the Ukrainians to kill them?
Well, what we're hearing is a load of propaganda on both sides. The Ukrainians are claiming they've killed loads of Russian generals. The Russians have not, you know, haven't said anything much about it one way or the other. And the Americans want to encourage the idea that they are helping the Ukrainians and that the Ukrainians are winning and they're killing loads of generals. But on the other hand, they suddenly think, ooh, that might make the Russians a bit mad if we confess to doing that. And then our own generals might end up like General Soleimani with a bullet or a bomb. And of course, the Russians up to now have tried to avoid killing high-ranking personnel on the other side because you're trying to negotiate with them. Negotiations are continuing as we speak, even though there have been no negotiations for 8 years. And the only reason the Ukrainians are negotiating is because they're under bombardment.
Now, what the
if they weren't under bombardment, they wouldn't be negotiating.
The Saker, who we interviewed on this program, whose base is blog in Iceland, he said a few weeks ago, he said the Russians haven't just taken on the Ukrainian Nazis, they've taken on the Nazis right around the world.
Well, don't forget, the Ukrainian Nazis have been built up by our own our own intelligence services as a means to an end, just as we built up Al-Qaeda in the 1980s.
I mean, in a way, this sort of links
end.
To some of my work on the Fourth Reich, you know, the idea that you've got this kind of financial Fourth Reich of people who are absolutely sympathetic with these racist, transhumanist now, but particularly racist agendas and the idea of dominating others in an extremely authoritarian fashion, having fake democracies, what Putin calls decorative democracies. But anyway, so let's have a listen now to this little clip from last week's, where I voiced up this and talk by Ukrainian general, supposed Ukrainian general anyway, Yan Kazimirovich, where he says the Zionists and the Masonic Mafia were behind the coup.
Mr. Yatsenyuk, Mr. Teretsuk, and others like them, I declare it openly, and I know it for a fact, that they are sponsored agents of the Central Intelligence Agency of the USA. Moreover, Mr. Yatsenyuk is the first deputy head of a Masonic lodge in Ukraine. And the head of the Masonic Lodge, if somebody doesn't know, is Mr. Pinchuk, a brother-in-law of Mr. Kuchma.
Actually, Pinchuk is quite an important figure. He's probably the most wealthy oligarch over in Ukraine, Martin, and he's a businessman, they say. He's also a philanthropist. He runs something called the Pinchuk Foundation.
And
he's also a dual Israeli-Ukrainian citizen.
Well, they're all philanthropists, aren't they? And then they're also entrepreneurs, or they could be oligarchs. All the same thing, aren't they? Let's face it.
One of the things that I found so interesting about this Masonic collection was it made me think about the whole P2 scandal back in the 1980s, which was talked about by Martin Short and Paul Foote and others at the time. So here's Paul Foote talking about Newham Council. I mean, it just obviously this isn't the national side of things, but it's I think quite interesting to hear from Paul. But Paul Foote had quite an important say on this. He was a very popular journalist in the 70s and the 80s, maybe 60s too, working for the Daily Mirror. But you don't really see hardly anybody like him in the London media these days.
Newham Council in the East End of London has an annual budget bigger than many third world countries. In 1980, a full roll of 75 members of the borough of Newham Lodge leaked out. Non-Masons were horrified to discover the extent of Freemasonry's influence in the Labour-controlled borough.
It actually permeated the whole social fabric of the borough. The membership of the lodge indicated that there were members of the council, senior members of the council in membership. There were the officers, the senior officers and lower officers. There were contractors. There were even police connections.
Because they mingle in secret and because they tie one another up in this secret bond to one another, the tendency among all these people that are in this secret society is to defend one another rather than to expose one another to public accountability.
So what we'll do, I think next week we will have a bit more of an in-depth look at the whole P2 scandal, Martin, because Martin Short, who I got to know personally before he died 2 years ago, he wrote a book called Inside the Brotherhood, and that book was a collection of loads of papers that had come to Stephen Knight when he died after writing The Brotherhood back in the mid-1980s. And he's he was a real aficionado on Freemasonry, and he did a fantastic job in looking at the P2 scandal over in Italy, which to me mirrors much of what we're seeing here, that really at the very top, Freemasonry, hidden Freemasonry, is a major factor. Victor Pinchuk is the guy that he talks about there, the Ukrainian general, and I thought we'd wind up this evening with a listen to a guy who the Victor Pinchuk Foundation invited, called Yuval Noah Harari. Have you come across him before, Martin?
Yeah, I read his books in lockdown.
Yeah, so what do you make of him?
Well, he's an Israeli academic, and he wrote a book called Sapiens, which is about the history of the human race, which is very well written and provocative stuff. And you know, he would argue that I'm just putting this stuff out there for people to discuss, but of course he's seen as, well, some people see him as in favour of AI and you know, transhumanism. I would say, having read his books, that he's not necessarily in favour of it. He's just saying this is happening and we need to talk about
this. This is what's going to happen, basically, I think. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to what he had to say about cyber war in this talk he did for the Victor Pinchuk Foundation. Of course, they all do foundations, don't they? All these oligarchs, the Rockefellers, etc.
Well, that's right. That's how you get your... Yes, that's right. So the money,
and
you
Gates,
put
it, of course.
You put your money in this because it's tax-free, and then, of course, the foundation can then push for what you want, you know, because they're independent.
Why don't we just pass,
and they can
a
push
law
for what you want in the rest of your
pass
business life.
A law to tax these foundations into the ground, because of course they're not just there for educational purposes, they're just there to push the ideas of this particular oligarch or that particular oligarch through some sort of charitable cover. But anyway, let's have a listen to Yuval Noah Harari speaking for the Pinchuk Foundation on cyber war.
There has not been a war between two great powers since the middle of the 20th century. The Second World War, maybe if you count the Korean War. And this is not because of accidents. This is because of deep changes in the nature of the international system, in the nature of economics and technology. Maybe the most important change is that once you have nuclear weapons, and today we are developing equally destructive weapons of different kinds, a great power war is mutual suicide. And this was never before the case in history. Again, there are reasons to be a bit less optimistic now, because, you know, with nuclear weapons, it was obvious that if you start a nuclear war, everybody is going to lose. Everybody is going to be destroyed. With the new arms race in areas like cyber technology and AI and so forth, there is a temptation that maybe I can win it. That when the other guy presses the button, nothing happens because I hacked their system. The Cold War confrontation between the USSR and the USA, the nuclear confrontation, it was like a chess game. That, you know, it's very cold and rational, and you can see forward, if we do this, they will do that. In the current situation, one of the frightening things about the new technologies is that they pour mist over the entire battlefield. You really have no idea what you can do and what the other side can do.
So that's Yuval Noah Harari speaking about cyber warfare there, Martin. He's saying we've moved into an area which we really don't know what's going to happen. Potentially, you could have a bit of a cyber war where all the electricity in the country is shut off by the enemy.
Yeah, and the only thing that stops the enemy doing that is you can do it to them. So it's just another aspect of this. You see, the point is that with the Ukraine, when the British destroyer, for example, was sailing into Crimean waters, which the Russians claim, that could have ended up with the destroyer being sunk. And at that point, NATO and Russia go to war, and at that point somebody may decide that they're under attack with a nuclear weapon and press the button.
We can have a series.
That's how close. In 1983, we very nearly lost the whole of the world with a nuclear confrontation. There was just accidental that we didn't, and that was in 1983. We're much closer to
it
now.
I remember John Pilger in his film The Coming War on China talking about the orders that were sent to actually launch the nuclear missile force from a Pacific island, is it Okinawa maybe, to China. And it was only not launched because the commander of the base said, hang on, we're not actually at war with China, so we're not going to do it.
Well, I was reading interesting stuff about the nuclear football the other day, you know, because the president makes the decision to press the button, blah, blah, blah. In actual fact, the decision to start a nuclear war has been subcontracted down to fairly low levels, so that some low-level commander, in Doctor Strangelove, can just decide they're going to do it. And this is the danger. This is why we have these treaties with the Soviet Union to get short-range missiles out of Europe, the SS-20 and the cruise missiles out, and that just stick with the good old-fashioned intercontinental ballistic missiles, and therefore there's plenty of time to get on the phone and say, what are you doing? Whereas if you've got short-range missiles, it's bang, and you've got to make your decision straight away.
To sort of come down to the justice system in a weird way, because, you know, if Kolomoisky, for all of his money laundering, had just been arrested and jailed, then, you know, things like the Azov Battalion would never have got a chance to get going. And, of course, what happens is all of the money that these criminal oligarchs are making, organised crime are making, goes into, for example, these sorts of far-right groups which are kicking this war off in the first place and keeping things going. Anyway, that's all. It's time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also thanks to sound engineer Dave Bazanko, and our guest from Knowle, independent councillor, former leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council, who the group, anyway, not Gary, used to run the city before we had a mayor. And download our MP3s to listen in the car. That's Gary Hopkins. To listen in the car or anywhere you like, do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page. We'll have more on P2 next week. You can subscribe to my weekly email list, even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft in Bristol and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and military disinformation is the norm in Britain today, thanks to the Nazi collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses here, the glorious Fourth Reich. So, if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and we'll credit you here. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock, I believe, next Friday. Sorry, we've been on 6 for a few weeks. Back to 5 next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.